Oh, and what did you say? Nobody looks at a man's shoes. I did not place that reference until somebody linked it in the show notes.
What a surprise. What a surprise. Neither one of you got my Monty Python one last week. Finally, one person on Twitter got it.
I don't know that I've seen Monty Python. I think I've seen Holy Grail, and that's the only Monty Python I think I've ever seen.
That's what I did. It was from Holy Grail.
I knew I recognized the reference about the shoes. I just couldn't place it until I saw the link. Does that give me, like, partial credit?
No, because Shawshank is not an obscure movie.
I know. It's one of my favorites, too.
It's not an obscure line from the movie, either. It is a very popular movie, right in your wheelhouse for your age group, and it is a pivotal, important line from the movie.
It is. I have no excuses.
No, you don't?
Sorry, Dad.
I try to tailor my things to you, and they just go by. The Monty Python I didn't expect you to get, because that's before your time. But I expected more people on the internet to get it, but only one person on Twitter got it.
Please love me anyway. I'll try to do better.
Okay, I'll do it.
September is, among other things, the most popular month amongst Apple people, but it is also a very, very, very important month. In September, it's National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, and our dear friend Stephen Hackett, his eldest son, Josiah, has been affected by childhood cancer since he was 6 months old, and two of Stephen's children are, including Josiah, are running or walking or doing some sort of marathon to raise money for St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And if you're not from the United States, St. Jude's is a children's research hospital. They take no money from their patients. They run entirely from donations and grants and things like that. And so this month, as every September, Stephen Hackett is trying to raise money for St. Jude's. And I can't think of a better, more universally agreeable target of your hard-earned money, listener, than a children's research hospital. And I mean that genuinely. And so Stephen originally had asked, or had not asked, but I had hoped to raise $9,000. As we record on Wednesday the 20th, he is at $17,000. And I will consider it a personal failing of the ATP listeners. We need a good name like Tim's, like Hello Internet has. But anyway.
Tim's is not a good name.
It's a fantastic name.
It is not, because it's gender specific, which is awful. They tried to brush over it on the re-show, and it drives me nuts. But anyway.
That's... We could call our listeners Upgradians. That probably isn't taken.
So anyway, we need to call the Ipsers. That didn't work at all. Anyway, we'll just edit that out. Don't worry. And whenever I say that, I know that means it's not getting edited out. Anyway, the fundraiser is at $17,048 as I sit here now. If we are not, I shouldn't say we. If the Hacketts haven't raised $20,000 by the end of September, I will consider it a personal failing of all of you that listen to ATP. And so I am asking, nay, begging all of you, perhaps the accidentals, if you will. That's terrible also, but yes. It's the best I got.
The accidents.
So I am, the accidents. That's really terrible. So I'm asking, we got to stop this. We'll workshop it. But anyway, we'll put it in the parking lot. I'm asking all of you to please, even if it's just a dollar, and I mean that, even if it's just a dollar, whatever, a dollar is more than no dollars. Please donate to the Hackett's fundraiser for St. Jude's. It would mean a lot to Stephen, and it would mean a lot to all three of us. So if you have any extra money with which you can scrape a donation together, and I mean that genuinely, I'm not trying to be a jerk, please consider throwing a little bit of your hard-earned money their way, because gosh knows they deserve it. So just a quick serious note on that. Anything else, you two?
I would go even further and say, if we don't hit $20,000, John will give you all a thumbs down
individually. He will tweet every single one of you individually.
All of the accidents he will tweet.
we don't want to just use the stick. We should use the carrot. If we break 20K, we should come up with a good name for ATP listeners.
Ooh, I like that.
That's putting a lot of pressure on us.
The person who makes it cross over 20K, send us a screenshot, and you might have input on what the name is.
Ooh, I like that too.
A screenshot, because those can't be fake.
Not at all.
I love it when people screenshot things. Look, take a screenshot. Then you'll have proof. Young people who grew up in a world with computers.
We can at least verify whether it has crossed $20,000 yet or not.
We can verify that.
You know, it would be at least everyone trying to fake it would have to do it at around the same time, at least. And this would be a good problem to have. All right.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, please, if you have any extra cash, please send it to St. Jude. And I know all of us would appreciate it. So thank you for that.
And look at it this way. Apple just released a whole bunch of new crap. none of which cost less than about $40. Like, of everything they released, like, is there anything that costs under $40? A single, any accessory or anything? Probably not, right? Even, like, if you want to get, like, if now your phone can fast charge, but you need to spend, like, $70 between a brick and a cable to make it fast charge. And we're willing to do that kind of crap all the time. Like, we geeks, fans, listeners of this show. So to drop, like, $50 or $100 to St. Jude for literally helping children with cancer, like, it's, as Casey said, it's pretty hard to find a more agreeable cause and a more beneficial cause than this. And the fact that the families who have to go through that literally do not pay a dime for the health care for, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars or more worth of health care that their children need, the last thing you want to worry about is, how are we going to pay for this? You know, that's a hard enough thing for people to go through. So to have that burden of the finances lifted from the parents who have to go through that is so remarkable that this is worth supporting. It's worth helping to make that possible when we can. So those of us who can, please help.
Yeah. And to go back to the stick rather than the carrot, the chat room is saying AT Peons is the leading contender right now.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to use if we don't get to 20K.
No, that would be an example of a bad name.
I know, that's my point. If
bad,
we don't
yeah,
get to,
bad.
If we don't cross 20K, we'll use AT Peons.
No, I don't like the stick. I like the carrot.
Oh, my word. All right, anyway, moving on. All right, so since we haven't had follow-up for a while, guess what, everyone? We've got a little bit of follow-up. So let's start with Marco. You apparently would like to slightly correct yourself about how you were slightly wrong about the iPhone X screen size.
Yeah, so last episode I was talking about the different screen sizes, and I pointed out that the iPhone X screen has the same resolution, the same point width as the iPhone 6, 7, 8, the non-plus version, which I was disappointed that we're not getting at least more width in screen real estate. But it turns out that while that was correct, it is the same number of points in the user interface, it actually is physically larger. I would still like to have the same density and just more space. But this is better than that, at least, because maybe this might allow you to, you know, set the dynamic text size one notch down. You know, so like you can kind of find ways to fit more on screen. It will also, of course, help with photos and video to look better because this is a true 3X screen. So we actually are getting, like, you know, nicer resolution. You know, photos will look better and everything. So it isn't a total loss on the width gain. There is some width gain, just no gain in points as measured by the screen.
So we should hoist up an item from Lower and Follow-Up. The guys who do Paint Code, because the URL is paintcodeapp.com, have a really cool diagram showing the resolution in points, so the logical resolution, the pixels, the physical resolution, and the physical size for all the phones that Apple, all the different size phones that Apple has made. It's a great diagram, and if you want to have a visualization of all this info all on one page that you can look at, we'll put that link in the show notes.
I will also say Paint Code is an amazing app. I used it to make my blog post of the month, and it's wonderful. I absolutely love it. And I have searched for this page pretty much at probably once every 2 weeks for the last 2 years. Like, because I always have to refer, like, wait, how wide is the plus again? Like, or I have some question, and I this is right at the top of my search results, and it's always purple because I've already clicked on it. And it's just, yeah, this page is very helpful. So thank you, Paint Code. Also, Paint Code is an awesome app.
All right. I don't think it was last episode. I think it was the episode prior, but in the last couple of episodes, we've talked about John's new MacBook Pro that he has at work and how he is now a resident of Dongletown. And I thought you covered, John, why you don't plug your mouse or keyboard into the back of the monitor. But let's talk about that. And could you also cover that everyone and their mother recommended, all the AT Peons recommend, I can't even do that with
don't
a straight
do
face.
Don't do it.
So bad.
That everyone recommended that that you use some Thunderbolt dock, of which there were like 5 or 10 different options. So can you kind of do a little refresher and build on that for us?
So long ago, no one remembers that show, except for me, I guess. why not plug the mouse and keyboard into the back of the monitor? I'll tell you why, because I forgot there were USB ports back there. I mean, whoever looks at a man's shoes? I don't look at the back of my monitor. I totally forgot they were there. So many listeners wrote in and said, hey, you should plug into the back of your monitor. And they were right, and I did, and it is better. So one port free.
Oh, there you go.
And now when I do manual KVM, I just have to swap the disconnect two things from their two different adapters and plug the two cables into the back. Anyway, I'm slowly phasing out my a Big Mac Pro at work. I just wiped a bunch of the disks today, so it's not long for this world. And I'll be down to just the one computer, and I won't have to swap it. But yeah, moving things to the back of the monitor, A, it actually works, which, you know, I doubted when people suggested that, and I said, oh yeah, I should use that. I said, oh no, what if that would be really convenient? But what if they don't work? But they do. It's fine. B, I think I'm probably just going to keep them there. Although I'm having some problems with my mouse cord. Like, my new keyboard tray doesn't support my mouse cord in the same way the old one did, and it kind of adds some extra friction. And now I'm starting to think about, like, I've got to find a Bluetooth mouse that I can deal with, because being corded is not, you know, it's not the way of the future, as they say. Second question, why not use insert my favorite Thunderbolt dock here? The main reason is that they're all really expensive, and I already have all these dongles and adapters that I spent a lot of my, discretionary desk budget at work on. And they gave me, some of the smaller dongles and stuff like that. And, you know, the cheapest Thunderbolt thing starts at around 100 and something, and they go up to like $300. But all that said, I have actually ordered the cheapest Thunderbolt dock I could find with a mini DisplayPort. And I'm going to see how that works out. If it actually does work better, I'll try to see if I can get that expense too. But if I don't like it, or if it's flaky, I'll just return it. So that's an update on my dongle town.
I'd also say too, like the various docks that people recommended, the two that got by far the most recommendations were the OWC one and the Elgato one, both of which are $300 and not very small, and externally powered by, you know, by their own power supply and everything. So, like, it isn't that surprising that maybe those can be more reliable than the little, like, you know, $30 to $60 dongles that we get. But they also aren't particularly portable. And it's also kind of a hard sell to tell people, oh, this new laptop that was more expensive than the one it replaced can be great if you spend $300 more on this semi-desktop brick-looking thing to make it into as useful as it used to be. Like, that's not a great sell.
Yeah, if I get work to pay for it, though. Like, I got the OWC one. They make, like, a big expensive one and a smaller one. I got the smaller, cheaper one for $150 in space gray with the one with mini DisplayPort on it. Put a link in the show notes. They don't do a good job of linking to items from their emailed invoices, so I'll just link to the page. But anyway, you'll see all of them there. I got some recommendations. Some people said they had tried a bunch of docks, and the OWC ones were very reliable, so, and I've had success with their things. So I'm going to try it.
We will see. Window management comes back again. We did get a lot of positive feedback from people who had never heard episode, 96? The end of 96, whatever episode it was we linked in our most recent episode. But we got a lot of complimentary feedback on that, which I appreciate, because as I think Marco agreed, that is my favorite episode of ATP, bar none. But anyway, we had lots of people writing in, well, John, why don't you use Stay Moom, Tiling Window Managers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So why not, John?
This has been discussed before, but I guess it's a perennial topic. I don't use them because they don't work the way I want them to work. I've tried all of them, and I thank people for sending suggestions, because maybe they'll always send one that I haven't heard of, but they just don't work the way I want them to work. Tiling, forget it. I don't want to tile at all. And Stay and Moom, I've tried, and they just don't you know, get into my workflow. A lot of them sort of are based on the notion that you have a fixed set of windows, or that you want to memorize a set of windows, but that's not the way I want it to work. I want it to just... You know, I want to be able to arrange my windows however I want them, whenever I want them, and have them be in the places where they are. I don't want them to be snapshotted and restored. I don't want them to snap to each other or the edges and be in thirds and halves. And, you know, as I've said, if I ever made a Mac app, it would be a window management app that would work the way I wanted it to work. But those type of system hacks are not really wise investments in terms of... If you're going to make a Mac app, you probably wouldn't be able to sell it in the App Store, and the Windows Server changes all the time, and yada, yada, yada. So anyway, I don't use those. I do it the old-fashioned way.
So I don't know anything about Mac programming, really, but couldn't you do that with, like, sending Apple event codes and Apple scripts?
Don't say Apple events. Don't say Apple events.
No, because, like, if you could, then that might make it hard in the future to, like, distribute this app widely publicly, but you could probably make some little scripts yourself that just kind of monitor for things and keep things where you want them to be.
No, it's not about keeping them. My window manager that I want would have to be, like, real time. Like, you know, kind of like when you drag things around in any application that has, like, smart guides, like OmniGraffle or Keynote or any of those things where... They have all sorts of guides and snaps and adjustable borders and grid things, but like none of those things, though. Not like a, you know, it, the UI would look like that. In other words, it has to be real-time drawing on your screen in response to things that you're doing. So forget about Apple events. Forget about any snapshot your Windows, which all those things are have problems because Windows are not identifiable. Like, they're identifiable for humans. Like, that's my whatever window, right? But inside the application, there's no sort of identifier of that window that matches up with your identifier. There's probably a bunch of unique IDs, and of course there's process IDs, and there's the window title, and there's maybe the document that it's opened if it's a document window, but that combination of things does not map directly to your conception of that window, right? And it's not so much about keeping the windows where they are, because I'm not going to resize my screen or anything like that. And that's what these things are trying to solve. Oh, we'll just snapshot your screen, so when you unplug and replug, everything will go back. What if I open 20 new windows and close 10 other ones, or close the window and open that same window again? My conception of it is that it's the same, but the application's conception of it is this an entirely new window, but I consider it the same window. When I go back to my computer and it restores the previous state, it doesn't know about all the new windows that I opened, has no idea where those are supposed to go, which is the problem with my screen changing size. And that one window that I think is the same window doesn't go back to where it was, because as far as the program's concerned, it's a new window. So I'm setting all that aside, I'm just saying window management in general, one screen, never changes. I want an application that helps me with window arranging, helps me be more anal retentive about lining things up so I don't have to do it manually a pixel at a time, which someday will be really hard for me to do. Like, I guess it's kind of hard at Retina already, but if we go like another doubling of screen resolution, I'm not going to be able to line things up by the pixel anymore. My eyes won't be good enough, and my shaky old hands won't be good enough. And then how will I live with my windows one pixel higher than where I want them to be?
Just remember, John, better to be anal retentive than anal expulsive.
Nice. Yeah, you got to do both. You can't keep it in.
Speaking about poopy things, let's talk Apple TV remote. So I stand by that it's really not that bad. And some people have written in and said I'm right, and other people have said I'm wrong. But Ed Morris writes, to John's point regarding who was able to use the Apple TV remote, my 5-year-old daughter. She whips that thing around like it's nothing. Arbone writes, hard to use. My 4-year-old and 68-year-old dad both use the Apple TV remote without issue. Additionally, Anonymous writes, I work at an Apple retail store. The complete list of complaints about the Apple TV remote. And that was the end of that section of either their tweet or email. They followed up and said, and I've had several people scream at me about because of a free U2 album. So a lot of people apparently don't have a problem with the Apple TV remote. We also got infinite feedback, I measured, about why don't you use such and such Amazon link? And I'm assuming it was like a case for the remote, or in some cases like a tail.
Oh, one of those like rubber condom things.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I have never tried these because I don't mind the Apple TV remote. Some days I like it. Some days I have ambivalence toward it. But I presume and thought that one or both of you guys have tried like a remote condom or a tail or whatever, right?
I haven't, because I just find, like, as much as the Siri remote annoys me, the idea of having some kind of big like rubber gummy thing around it, that just seems even worse. Like, those things are just ugly and just feel weird. And the whole reason you buy Apple stuff is because it's nice. Like, I want this remote to be nice, to fit in with the other nice things that are in my, you know, couch and living room area. Like, I don't want some weird rubber thing around it. Like, the real solution is fix the damn remote. Like, the real solution is make the remote work nice rather than just having it look nice. Apple used to be able to do both.
So the reason I put all these quotes in here is because I think they're a good example of how... I was going to say how people can get used to anything, but it's not get used to. It's more like, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. If you had, in the DOS era, everyone's using, you know, DOS and its precursor operating systems on, you know, Apple II and all sorts of other, like Tandy, Commodore PET, whatever, Commodore 64. They're all command lines, right? And everybody's using them, and... most people would agree that there is some baseline level of difficulty of using computers. But even in that environment, plenty of people would say the Commodore 64 is not hard to use. My 8-year-old daughter has no problem. You know, my 5-year-old is on the Commodore 64 all the time and they love it. So how hard could it be to use? And my 68-year-old dad uses a Commodore 64 and he's fine, right? And if, say, there was a graphical operating system that comes along and some people are still using DOS... You might say, well, okay, so DOS can be learned and used by people old and young, but computers could be easier to use. Look at this. And the opinion you could have there is, well, you may think that's better, but only sort of froofy connoisseurs care about these so-called usability and user-friendliness that's better. I know WordStar and DOS backwards and forwards, and I teach a class of 7th graders to use it, and they're experts in it. And so you may think this whole thing with like little pictures of folders and stuff is better, but it must be better in some subtle way that that only essentially hipsters, although they didn't have that word back then or didn't mean the same thing, only hipsters can appreciate, right? But in the grand scheme of things, time has shown that a graphical user interface is in general better than having everybody use the command line. And it took a long time for that to happen, but at any given point when the command line was still the paradigm and GUIs existed, it wasn't clear. They would say, I have no problem with the command line. Well, Apple's remote, and indeed all remotes, this was brought up by people, all remotes are pretty terrible, with a few exceptions. And you might say, well, they're bad, but people use them all the time. Like, whatever, there's a remote that comes with your cable box, and yeah, it's a little bit weird and complicated, but, you know, my five-year-old picks that remote right up and knows right what to do, blah, blah, blah. How bad could the remote really be? There exists good remotes, but people would say, oh, maybe that's better, but only better in weird, subtle ways that, like, remote hipsters and real connoisseurs of, you know, usability snobs might care about, right? I think we're in the same situation where most remotes are terrible. People get by with them because they can get the job done. And by the way, one point that a lot of people brought up that we should be fair to the Apple remote. One thing the Apple remote does have going for it is that it doesn't have a lot of buttons, which is one of the big complaints about most remotes that you see, right? All that said, that we can exist in the world where all that is true, and also the Apple TV remote is awful for all the reasons that we have stated, right? Just like the other remotes are awful for different reasons. They have way too many buttons, and maybe the buttons are hard to press, or they die after a certain period of time. But even though the Apple TV remote has a small number of buttons, it is worse than your average cable box remote in important reasons, like how easy is it to find? How easy is it to pick up without inadvertently doing something? How easy is it to find which way is up? How safe do you feel when picking it up? Or do you have to pick it up like a game of Operation? Because if you touch anywhere on the touchpad, something is going to happen. And do people have accidental inputs and have trouble doing the gestures? Yes, they do. I see it all the time. Does it mean that they can't use it and it's like one of those as seen on TV commercials where the person gets, you know, eggshells in their hair and their house catches on fire when they're trying to make an egg? Oh, eggs are so messy. Like, no, it just means that it's not a good remote. And how do we know it's not a good remote? Because better remotes exist. The TiVo remote is absolutely 100% a better remote. Easy to find, easy to pick up, easy to grip. You can use it in the dark. Once you learn how it feels, you can use the select button and the five-way and the play pause and a bunch of buttons that are different shapes that are all under your fingers that are prioritized. The important ones are close to you and the unimportant ones are far away. It's an amazing remote, right? It's not like we don't know how to make a good remote. And it's also telling that almost no remote is as tiny and skinny as all the Apple TV remotes because they get caught in the couch cushions because they're hard to pick up. And almost none of them have an always-on, completely active, capacitive touch swipey thing on them because then it's very difficult to pick up. And almost none of them are symmetrical front and back in ways that you can't tell without either looking at it or putting a rubber band around it or something. So, yes, your five-year-old daughter can use it. And, yes, your 60-year-old dad can use it. But it is a bad remote. We should want better. We know better can exist. The difference may seem subtle to you, but it's not subtle. In the long term, we will look back on this remote and say, this is the hockey puck mouse of the remotes. And we'll say that when Apple finally makes one that's better.
I saw these quotes appear in the show notes. And because I'm the eternal optimist, I thought, I think I added the last one, but I thought, maybe they're realizing, the two of them, that things aren't so bad. I should have known, however, that this was just a bait and switch waiting for me and that, oh no, this is just more fodder.
I mean, it's like that. DOS is not so bad either, right? I mean, people used it for years. It's fine. You get the job done, right? You could even get kind of good with it, but it is worse than a GUI for most people. And this, and again, the things that make a good remote are not mysterious. Like the reason we are so angry is because they're obvious problems with it. The fact that it's so small. I mean, I think it's actually better for five-year-olds because their hands are so tiny. Regular people's hands, it's like trying to change a channel on a stick of Wrigley Spearmint gum. Like, no. Like, it's not... that's not how big my hands are, right? Just make it so that...
Oh, my word.
Anyway, I'm still angry about the remote. You can feel free to suffer through it.
I had no idea. All right, so...
That was glorious.
Do you have good news for us, John, with regard to fans and the Apple TV 4K?
I asked last week for some very pointed questions about the Apple TV, and I got some responses that I consider hopefully reliable and authoritative. The Apple TV 4K does not have a fan. So that question answered. Does have holes in the bottom, or the bigger holes than the other one did, but it does not have a fan. So thumbs up on that. And about the 24 frames per second cadence, still a little bit of mystery. The only direct feedback I got was someone telling me that it can do 4K 24 frames per second, but not 1080p 24 frames per second, but then on parentheses on my TV. What does that mean? Does that mean that the box can't do it or your TV can't do it? I don't know. It will not automatically switch. Apple doesn't seem to believe TVs will change video modes fast enough or reliably enough to make it worth it. So my parsing of this is that perhaps, I don't have this box yet, my order has not arrived yet, but perhaps you can set the thing to output 24 frames per second to your 4K television, in which case I guess the menus and the whole interface would be 24 because it never changes modes, which is not ideal because what if you want to watch a television show that's 30 frames per second or 29.9797 or whatever the hell it is. Like, bottom line is I want it to switch modes. I want it to switch modes the same way that the other boxes that connect to television can and do to match the cadence of whatever content it is showing. If you can find a number that's a multiple of 24 and 30, those numbers exist. I swear they do. Math tells me so. Then you can get away with it just by having a higher refresh rate and then, you know, duplicating frames an equal number of times. But anyway, we'll all find out when we get our televisions. Marco can find that on his fancy TV. I'll find that on my old TV, and we'll see. But there is a glimmer of hope, I guess.
All right, and then Lane Watson writes in to say, I online chatted with an Apple rep about any streaming or cash benefit favoring the 64 gig Apple TV, and they were advised that the capacity difference is for downloading only.
I refuse to believe. Say it isn't so. I mean, I the only reason I'm holding on a shred of hope like Casey about the follow-up, being optimistic, is that it's an Apple rep, and very often, like, is it like a salesperson? Is it somebody at an Apple store? How would they know? How would they know how big the cache is for downloaded movies, the flexible storage management, the variant of iOS that it's using? Who knows what it's doing? Like, we already know there's a whole way in iOS and in macOS, I think, where you can tag data as purgeable. But so essentially use all the space you want, but the operating system will consider it purgeable. So if it needs that space, it will chuck it. They have that technology. Why would they not use it? It's not, what do you think? You're telling me that the 64 and the, what is the smaller one, the 32... reserve exactly the same fixed amount of space for downloaded movies? It's plausible, I suppose it is, but I want to believe that they instead say, hey, guess what? When we cache downloaded movies, we're going to use that great API that we introduced 2 years ago that lets me mark data as purgeable, and we'll just use up as much space as we want, knowing full well that if anything else in the system needs that space, it will dump it. Please let that be the case. Anyway, I ordered 64 mostly because I wanted to give them enough money to make a new remote.
Even though they didn't. No, I mean, I also ordered 64 because it's only $20 difference on an almost $200 purchase. So I figured, like, this might never matter, but usually I keep Apple TVs for a pretty long time. They aren't updated that frequently, so even if you buy every one, you're still keeping it for, you know, a few years at least. So I figure, just in case it matters for anything I choose to do either now or down the road, I'll take the extra $20 risk. Again, I don't know why they even have this difference and why this premium priced thing needs to have two different models separated by $20, but for some reason it does. And I guess it worked on me and John because we gave them the extra $20. I would say if you are too unwilling to do that, give $20 to St. Jude.
Yeah, I bought the big one of the previous one too, and it is totally because I want to give money towards this product because I want them to make this better because I bought a lot of movies in iTunes and I don't want to go through the hassle of having to un-DRM them.
Wow. Wait, I have a couple of questions or thoughts. First of all, they've now updated the Apple TV twice in as many years, haven't they?
I believe the first one came out 2 years ago, the Apple TV 4. So it's on a roughly 2 to 3 year cycle historically.
Okay. Well, in either way, when do you keep anything Apple makes for more than like an hour ever, Marco?
Oh, I was looking at laptops on eBay this week. I didn't pull the trigger on any of them, but I was looking.
There we go.
Oh, I forgot to mention some more dongles. It's not the fault of the computer, but speaking of my new MacBook Pro, I think it is the fault of some terrible third-party software that work insists on installing on it that I have hopefully disabled. But I would disconnect it from my monitor, and then I would open the lid, and it would just sit there with a black screen staring at me. And it would be working fine. I could tell because you could Command-Tab, and you'd see the touch bar changed. I would recognize, oh, that's the touch bar from Safari. Oh, that's the touch bar. You know what I mean? Like, I could tell that the computer was working.
That's a clamshell thing.
Yeah, the screen was 100% black.
Yep, yep. Clamshell thing.
And there's like no way to bring it back. The only way I found to bring it back is if I logged out, it would show me the login screen, right? So then the screen would come back on. I have no idea why it's the case. But anyway, I think it's because of some stupid display link driver for some kind of USB-driven hub.
Nope.
And I disabled that and I haven't had the problem since, so fingers crossed.
Give it time.
Probably isn't.
Yeah, my experience is that that does happen probably once a week if you're not diligent about like either opening the lid before you unclamshell or sleeping the computer before. No, actually, I've had it happen when I sleep the computer.
Well, I'll try the open the lid thing if it starts happening. I need to know all the secret incantations to make a laptop work like a real computer.
That's so bad.
No, I mean, this is like my experiment this summer mostly failed. Like I was going to like bring home the LG monitor and, you know, and replace this iMac with my clamshell MacBook Pro setup until the Mac Pro comes out next year. And one of the reasons why I'm not doing this is because it turns out using a laptop as a desktop can work, but a real desktop does a way better job of it on a number of fronts. And so if you can afford to have a desktop and a laptop as separate computers, you generally will not regret that decision if you do a lot of work with it as a desktop. And I do. I work almost only with it as a desktop. And in fact, what I probably should have done is kept Mike's MacBook Escape and just gotten my, and either brought this iMac to the beach or literally spent the difference of money on a new iMac just for the summer usage. that would have been a better use of the money than buying myself another 15 inch and then forcing it to be a desktop for most of its life. So next time I buy a laptop, I intend for it to be only a laptop. And if you have the luxury, dear listeners, of using your laptops only as laptops, you have a much better experience than if you try to make a laptop behave and be used as a desktop.
While you said that, a lot of people ask why I don't have a desktop. Work won't let me. I have to get a laptop. That's why I'm doing this. I would rather have a desktop.
I don't know if I agree with you, Marco, about laptops being terrible as desktops. I think the problem is Mac OS and MacBook Pros or Mac, really any Macs, they're not well suited for clamshell, because if you do like the LCD by itself or the LCD sitting next to an external monitor, that generally speaking works pretty darn well. The problem that you have, which I share and I hate just like you do, is that clamshell mode is just good enough to keep us using it, but pretty freaking terrible all told. And that's where everything falls apart. So I wouldn't say that laptops are on the whole completely unusable as desktops. It's just the way you and I prefer, and John actually prefer to use them, is not that great and is fraught with peril.
I wonder if you can bring an iMac on the ferry.
I don't see why not. It's heavy though.
You can bring it to Panera Bread.
Yeah, right.
Is it just Panera now? Did they drop the bread? They probably dropped the bread.
We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to learn more. With bone conduction headphones, small transducers rest in front of your ears against your cheekbones, not inside or around your ears. And they send little vibrations that you can't feel through your cheekbones directly into your inner ear. So without having anything right on or in your ears are left completely open to hear the outside world. And this also brings some major benefits. If you feel uncomfortable with earbuds or in-ear monitors because they're sticking in your ear, you don't have to worry about that. Your ears are left open to the air. If other headphones make you really sweaty or you want something to wear while you're working out or during hot weather, this doesn't have that problem either because, again, nothing's covering up your ear and making it all sweaty. And they stay in place during exercise. They are IP55 certified for water resistance. You don't have to worry about them getting sweaty or getting rained on. The best thing about them, though, is that you are hearing the world around you. You are hearing everything because your ears are not blocked, in addition to your music or your podcasts. So this is actually not so good in very loud surroundings, like a train station. You can't hear it very well. But it's awesome if you want to listen to a podcast or take a phone call while you're doing something outdoors or around your house. So like if you're walking or running, you really want to hear the world around you for your own safety or convenience. If you want to listen around the house or at work, if you want to listen to a podcast or take a phone call without missing what's going on in the house or office, or maybe someone's knocking on your door, you don't want to miss it, it's fantastic. They are incredibly useful tools for listening to podcasts or taking phone calls when you don't want to block out the world around you. I've been using Aftershock's Trex Titanium and now the new Trex Air, and they are both fantastic. The Titanium is wonderful. It's my overall favorite because it fits really nicely in my pocket. The Trex Air is almost as pocketable, just a little bit different shape, makes it a little bit less pocketable, but it sounds better and is lighter. So it's really up to you which one you pick, but I think you can't go wrong with either one of them. They have great battery life. They're water resistant. They are by far my favorite portable headphones, especially during hot weather. So check it out today at atp.aftershocks.com, and you can get a pair of Trex Titanium for just $99.95. Regular price is $130, so that's a nice discount there. Once again, atp.aftershocks.com. Thank you to Aftershocks for sponsoring our show.
All right, let's talk about Apple Watch with LTE. Another thing that, in this case, I was fired up about, and you guys were less so. So Charles Arthur has written a blog post that's relatively long, but there's a really good poll quote that I have here. And he was saying, you know, that in the same way I was, that the $10 a month that Americans are being charged is outrageous. And he said, why is it outrageous? Because watch cellular data use is not additive. It's substitutive, whatever that word is I'm looking for. If you're pulling in data on your cellular watch, you must have left your phone behind. Ergo, you're doing nothing with the phone. It's consuming next to no data. The data consumption is shifted to your watch. And I know that this is probably not 100%, you know, completely and utterly true, but I think his point is fair in that in general, you're going to be using data on your phone or your watch in general and not both.
But data usage doesn't matter. You're not, there's no additional data. They don't care where you use your data. It's, if the carrier has an actual argument, it's that, network capacity, because your phone is still on the network. It's still hogging whatever, you know, spectrum and identification space that could be used by another phone that's in use. It's not off the network when you're away from home. It is still on the network. So that would be their answer. But, you know, like I said, the real answer has nothing to do with how much does it cost the carrier to have an additional device. It's what will the market bear? And that gets us back to the root problem, which is that the market for telecom in the U.S. is not as competitive as it should be. There are a very small number of very large companies that probably collude and do terrible things that we don't like, and there's nothing we can do about it. And so that's why we're angry. And this is just like, this is U.S. carriers flexing their muscle, they're taking advantage of the situation they're in, and our complaint is really, we don't like the situation they're in. And that's why other countries have these obscenely inexpensive rates, because either they have better systems of government or companies that are actually competing with each other, or the government mandates that the companies have to be interchangeable in a certain way, or all sorts of things that make their environment for telecom better than the environment in the U.S. And that's really what we're angry about at the root. Not so much, oh, this isn't worth $10, and let me tell you, because it doesn't cost them $10 to do this. That's not how business works. It doesn't matter how much it costs them to do something. It just matters what the market will bear. And so the market is messed up in the U.S.
Well, I think it's both. I also don't think it's worth this kind of money.
Yeah, but you can't have that kind of thinking. Like, I mean, it doesn't cost Marco any more money when someone buys a new copy of Overcast. So does that mean it's not worth it? It's what the market will bear, right? He doesn't have to, like, carve the bits out of a little stone tablet every time someone subscribes to Overcast Premium or whatever.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And I should also add that I saw a ton of feedback about what other countries are being charged, and if there was anyone who said, oh, yeah, it's the same as America, then I genuinely don't remember it, because pretty much everyone said, like, Australians were saying it's about $5 a month in either Australian or American dollars. I forget which. Canadians said it's about $5 a month, or five loonies, or whatever it is they use up there.
That sounds right. They're sorry.
They're so very sorry. And also, you know, confirmation bias alert coming up. I did not see anyone say to me, no, you're crazy, and it's exactly how much, $10 a month is exactly right, and you should stop whining. Now, I probably should stop whining, but I was stunned, because just about everything I say on this show, somebody will come out of the woodwork to disagree with, and I did not see not one of those. And I concede unequivocally, this is confirmation bias at its finest, but I, hand on heart, I do not remember seeing anyone say that. So it doesn't mean that those people don't exist, and please, for the love that is of all that is good and holy, that does not mean, listener, that agrees with Marco, that this is your moment to shine. I know that you're out there, and I know there are people that disagree with me. I was just surprised how few people wrote in, because that number seemed to be zero. Anyway, moving on. Craig Federighi went on a press tour to talk about the Face ID recognition flub up and upswipe overlap and all sorts of different things. Does one of you want to tell us about this?
I put this in here. I'm linked to the talk show where Craig went on with John Gruber, and they had a conversation, too short conversation, because I guess they were busy and had a lot of things to do. Only 30 minutes, but worth listening to. And Andreas Gobrud didn't say that this interview on the talk show confirmed the idea that I put forward last show about how the iPhone X could let you swipe up before it has recognized your face, just let you do it. And if in the process of, you know, it's doing the animation to show you the screen where you have to type in your passcode to unlock the phone, if during that process at any point it recognizes your face, just go straight through it, rather than saying, hold the phone up to your face, wait for it to recognize your face, then swipe up. So Craig confirmed that it does, in fact, overlap them. And, it, you know, that's a smart thing to do. And Apple has smart folks. And so that's what they're doing. And so we'll put a link in the show notes to the entirety of that episode, and also the timestamp at, I think, 16 minutes and 45 seconds, where you can hear that bit.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of happy that, I mean, I know it probably really sucked for Apple that the demo failed on stage, but I'm actually kind of happy that that the result of that has been, we've gotten some really great interviews out of Craig over the last few days. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that it happened, but it's kind of nice for fans of the company following all this stuff to have all this additional exposure and information and good questions being asked and getting more details about how Face ID works, because the iPhone X is still a while out. Like, it's still, you can't even order it for over a month from now. And it's probably going to be at least, I would say, probably January before a lot of people even have them. So this is still a while out. So to get any more information earlier is kind of nice.
You don't think he would have gone on this, done all this press if the demo hadn't failed for explicable reasons?
No, I don't.
I agree.
Craig is going around doing all these interviews all of a sudden, talking about Face ID and how awesome it is because it failed on stage. And this is a form of damage control. That seems to make sense. I mean, part of it is also like reacting to people's concerns about how secure and private it is. But I don't think that would have been enough to get an Apple executive to go give interviews like this. I think it's because it failed, and there was some bad press about that, because it didn't just get noticed by nerds like us. Like, everyone noticed, and there were news articles about it. So, like,
yeah, it was the worst kind of mistake, because like it is explicable, but there's nuance in the explanation, and nobody wants nuance. All they want is Apple demo fails.
Yeah, there's no way this would have happened had the demo not gone the way it did. But again, I think this is good for us. And ultimately, it's fine for Apple, because long term, no one's going to remember this. But it's good for us to get all these wonderful interviews. And Craig's a pretty awesome person. And there's always tons of info in anything that he says publicly. He obviously is very familiar with technical details, with implementation details, with reasons that they do things. And he's able to explain those so well that he gives really good interviews about technical topics. And so it's always really nice to hear more from Craig.
Someone had a funny tweet when people were leaking supposed, you know, inside news from the tense rehearsals after the leak, right? When all the Apple people were rehearsing their thing, knowing that all this information had leaked out there, and they're all angry about it, and everyone was yelling at everybody. And someone tweeted that the worst thing about this Apple leak is learning that Craig Federighi yells at people sometimes. Don't want to believe it. Not Craig. Hair Daddy would never yell at me.
I'll tell you one thing, like hearing that he was like yelling and getting mad, that drove home to me like, wow, they must be really mad.
Assuming it's even true. I mean, that's just random hearsay from, like, I'm sure people who are inside the room during the rehearsals are texting secrets out of it. Who knows?
Yeah, I that's the one thing when we heard those rumors, the one thing I kept thinking of, like, how many people could possibly have been in that room?
Right. Are they on their phone in the audience going, this is wild, guys?
Yeah. It's not like there's like somebody in, like, you know, how many are there, like 10 people in the room? Like, and they're not going to be like you know, low rank people who are going to be leaking stuff. Like, they're not going to have like any random person in the room when they're rehearsing their super secret keynote days before the event.
Anyway, everyone's human, and I'm sure people were mad, and it was a difficult time. And that demo, it was rough because, like, especially I don't hold regular people to this, or even like the regular press, but for the tech nerds, we'll get into this. Actually, the next very next item. Let's just transition to it immediately because I will make the point in both contexts at once to save time. The next item here is that APFS support for Fusion drives is not in the release version of High Sierra. It was in the betas, and Apple talked about it, and it would totally be a thing that you can have. But then when they got ready to do the release version, said, you know, here it is, right from Apple's page, which we will link. If you installed the beta version of macOS High Sierra, the Fusion drive in your Mac may have been converted to Apple file system, basically if you check that checkbox, you know, that they present during the betas. Because this configuration is not supported in the initial release of macOS High Sierra, we recommend that you follow the steps below to revert back to the previous disk format. And this is a long, arduous series of steps to convert back. This, and also the on-stage demo of an unreleased product, for tech nerds specifically, not for the regular press, not for, you know, casual people, but for tech nerds specifically, this is what unreleased software, unreleased hardware and beta software means. It means that it might not work right and things might change before the release. And if you enter into a beta or watch a demo of something that is unreleased with the expectation that everything absolutely must work perfectly and will not change before release, you are misunderstanding what a beta is. It just so happens that most of the time Apple is good with its betas and more or less does a steady progression from early betas to late betas that converges on a finished product that we expect. But this is exactly what happens during betas. The feature is there. They do all the betas on it. They want to release it eventually. Sometimes things get cut. APFS will convert your SSD unconditionally, blah, blah, blah. They make that policy decision. And they say the one that's working on Fusion drives has a few more problems. We're going to hold that back. It will not be in the initial release. And if you're using a beta and all of a sudden you're really mad, you're like, oh, it converted my drive, but now the release version won't work with it, blah, blah. It was a beta. This is what betas are all about. I think people are spoiled by betas that basically never have any harmful effects and they can smoothly sail right from them to the release version. That shouldn't be expected to be the norm, nor should it be expected that an unreleased piece of hardware and unfinished software should demo perfectly on stage. Never mind the fact that the hardware and the software both worked as expected. It was a procedural error having to do with the demo. Basically, the people who were cleaning the fingerprints off the thing accidentally locked them by activating Face ID too many times. Which would make sense even if Face ID required a swipe up. Anyway, I just want to, you know, tech people should remind themselves, not done, beta, unreleased, those are all things that we should expect, that there will be bugs and there will be changes before release. So anybody who is super mad about that and is also a tech nerd needs to, like, check themselves a little bit.
Before they wreck themselves, I know.
I mean, also just like, you know, everyone always asks, every time there's a beta season, we get tons of questions, people saying, is it okay to install the beta on my phone or whatever else? And for an iPhone, you know, my answer is always like, if you're able to do a restore at any time and tolerate that amount of downtime, because that might happen with pretty much any beta, then sure, you know, you can give it a try if you want. Like, if you don't need your phone to be that reliable, fine. And I usually put the betas on my main phone, usually around beta 2 or 3. I have never installed a macOS beta on my real computer, ever. And I don't intend to. Like, to me, the needs that your computer has should be far more conservative than what you're willing to do on, like, an easily restored iOS device. Your computer, like, that is, like, for me, at least, I know this is maybe an antiquated view these days, but the computer for me is, like, my primary store of everything. Like, it is my master device. If everything else fails, my computer still has to work. I need, like, the computer has the master copy of all the data. It is the thing that I can back up the most, that I can, you know, that I can rely on the most, the thing I need to use the most for work purposes and for hobby stuff. Like, I need my computer to be reliable all the time at any cost. And so the idea of installing beta software of my main computer OS in a way that, like, formatting a drive or losing all data would be inconvenient or a problem or slow me down at all, that just sounds like a terrible idea to me. Like, the only time I've ever installed a beta has been on a laptop when I have not needed to use it anytime soon. And even then, that like I almost never even do that. Like, you know, I think the last time I did it was when they did Safari Reading List, and I wanted to see what that was like because I was still running Instapaper and I was worried that it would be too good, and nobody could tell me how it was, so I installed the beta. But otherwise, like, most people have no good reason, unless you're a Mac developer working on, you know, cutting edge stuff. Most people have no good reason to install macOS betas at all. And if you're going to do it, do it on basically a disposable installation. Do it on a disposable partition, on a disposable disk, on a computer that you don't really need right now. Never ever do it on anything that matters, because that's like, it's hard enough for them to get macOS releases stable when they are released to the public. Like, let alone in the beta. Like, forget it.
Yeah, I've never put a macOS beta on anything I've ever owned. And I can't imagine a reason I would, other than what you've described, Marco. Like, it just seems really a poor choice to me, unless you're, you know, like a macOS developer, like you said. And similarly, generally speaking, I avoid putting betas on my phones. You and I both made the critical rookie mistake of, was it the one with
iOS 5.
With notification center that oh man, you and I think ran right back to our hotel rooms right after the keynote or something like that. I mean, it doesn't matter exactly when it was, but it was,
we did it over lunch,
or maybe I think that's what it was. It was something like that, that the both of us were like foaming at the mouth. We were so excited to do this, and I think it took both of us but hours to deeply regret our actions. And ever since then, like, I know that you, just like you said, you put on betas relatively quickly, but I don't think for the last two or three versions of iOS, I don't think I've put a beta on my phone. I think I might have, you know, like this with iOS 11, I think I've been running the GM since it was released a few days back, but I don't think I've put an honest to goodness beta on my phone in a long time. And I agree, Marco, that once you get through the first two or three, usually it's pretty okay. But in my experience, since I don't absolutely need to for work and I can get, you know, I can get my hands on test devices and things like that, and we're rarely on the bleeding edge for these sorts of things anyway, I don't recommend it, generally speaking, because you never know what's going to happen. And my phone and my computer, I agree with you, Marco, 150%, that those I do not want to mess with. Now, my iPad has been on iOS 11 for a while, because for me, the iPad is kind of expendable. And if it doesn't work, oh well.
Yeah, like that's a reasonable way to do it. But like, and like, for most people, I can't think of a compelling reason. Like, like, I don't install macOS betas because, honestly, I just don't care. Like, I don't, macOS improves so slowly these days that, like, I can't even tell you what's in High Sierra besides the file system.
I know.
Like, I know there's a couple of things, but most of it's like, here's some improvements to Safari. Like, the Safari team is really pulling the weight of the entire OS when it comes to, like, notable features that can be bullet points on a slide somewhere. Like, you know, if you exclude Safari changes, it's a pretty thin release as far as user-facing features go. And of course, every release of macOS 10 these days breaks something also. So it's like, I have to wait, like, am I willing to tolerate whatever part of, you know, networking or USB or graphics or the PDF subsystem or whatever, like, whatever they broke, audio, like, whatever they broke in this version of macOS, am I willing to tolerate that to get whatever the new stuff is? And usually there's so little new stuff that I can be very conservative and patient with the version of macOS I choose to run. And
you should check software update, because you can get that new Safari right now on the iMac you're sitting in front of. I installed it today at work.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, same.
Yeah. No more auto-playing videos. Yeah. Going to the settings.
Yeah, in that case, what do I need High Sierra for?
You got the most important feature, the file system. That's the one that Apple is advertising the most, right? Or wait, no, is it just this program? On betas, I've also had iOS 11 on my iPad for real time. And also because iOS 11 was so iPad focused and had all the fancy iPad features that I really wanted to see. But yeah, I don't care about my iPad stability that much. And so I suffered through some weird bugs. I didn't upgrade my phone. And that meant I was kind of startled when I finally did upgrade to iOS 11 on my phone by a few things. I already complained about one on Twitter about that I missed the dots. I didn't think I would miss the dots, but guess what? I missed the dots and for the signal strength thing.
Oh, the little circles. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of missed them. But really, the one thing that surprised me the most is that even with reduced motion enabled, which you know I love to have enabled, when I unlock my iPhone 7 with Touch ID, a big curtain raises from the bottom, almost as if I had flicked upward, like on an iPhone 10, right? But I didn't flick upward. I just used Touch ID. And even when reduced motion is on, that big curtain goes upward. And it's not a big deal. doesn't bother me that much, but I kind of miss whatever the old animation was, probably a crossfade. It probably takes the same amount of time, but it's an animation that I'm not accustomed to seeing. And I guess I'll get used to it, but it's one of that's one of the things that I would have known about months and months ago if I had been installing the betas, and I could have complained about it earlier, and you know how important that is to me to get complaints out early. so that Apple can potentially fix them. But this is not a big deal. It's not like my lack of lasers, which could not stand, as we know.
Yeah, but you got that eventually.
I know. Yeah, no, it took a whole week. We had to wait till the next show.
I'm still bitter that I lost that bet.
And at such speed, too.
I know, exactly. It really, really rubbed my face in it. To that end, you know, something I've noticed, which I think this is legitimate, and I'm not just bananas, but I have a picture of Aaron and Declan as my lock screen, backdrop, whatever it's called, wallpaper, I guess, and if I tap the sleep-wake button, the thing that's still there on the iPhone X, I feel like it kind of fades in a way that's different than iOS 10. And I don't know how to describe it. And I tried to take a screenshot of it.
Yeah, it does. It does fade in.
Okay, so I'm not totally bananas. Well, at least not for that reason anyway.
Yeah. There's a bunch. Like, iOS 11 adds even more. People who don't have reduced motion on, are even those people are a little bit startled by the more sort of expressive animations about applications flying back into their icons and all sorts of cross fades and things. I think it looks nicer in general, but if it has pushed some people over the edge. Like, they could tolerate the amount of animations in iOS 10, and iOS 11 just pushed a few more people over the edge to go hunting for that reduced motion thing.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture, printing your photos in vivid color directly onto glass. Visit fractureme.com/podcast to learn more and get 10% off your first order. Fracture is out to rescue your favorite images and photos from the digital ether. They will print photos directly onto glass and add a laser-cut rigid backing so it's ready to hang up or display right in the box. They even include the wall anchor if you want to use one. All you have to do is upload your digital photo and pick your printed out size. It's that simple. The Fracture printing process makes the color and contrast of your photos really pop, and the sleek, frameless, all-glass design lets your photos stand out while still matching any decorating style. Really, Fracture had the first edge-to-edge display in these prints, and they look fantastic. With Fracture prints, you can bring a special memory to life. You can give it as gifts also. They make wonderful gifts for your friends and family. Getting photos printed of, you know, your kid or your pets or funny things between your friends makes such a fantastic gift for pretty much any occasion, or just no occasion at all. Just, you know, sending a nice little lovely gift to your friends and family. We have many Fractures in our house. I have many in the room sitting in right now, and we've sent many as gifts. They get so many compliments. People love these things. They look great, and they're surprisingly affordable. Fractures also come with a 60-day happiness guarantee, so you are sure to love your order. And each Fracture is handmade in Gainesville, Florida, from U.S. source materials in a carbon-neutral factory. For more information and 10% off your first order, visit fractureme.com/podcast. That is really the URL. I'm not making a mistake or reading you a placeholder. It's fractureme.com/podcast. That's where all the podcast landing pages go, and then they will ask you, which podcast did you hear about this from? Pick ATP in that survey to help us out and support the show. Once again, fractureme.com/podcast to get 10% off your first order, and mention ATP in the one question survey that asks which podcast you came from. Thank you very much to Fracture for sponsoring our show.
All right. So an anonymous Apple retail employee writes, on the back end of something, there were some significant changes to the way that the Genius Bar appointments work. 2 years ago, you more or less had to already have made an appointment online to be seen. Today's Genius Bar holds back the majority of personnel in order to improve the experience for those walking into the store to ultimately be seen within 5 to 30 minutes. Because of this, there is much less availability for those who are enrolling from home. Please feel free to encourage the world to walk into a store and be helped rather shortly. The ultimate goal here is to do away with the days of, quote, needing an appointment in order to see someone at the Genius Bar. I have such mixed feelings about this, because on the one side, I when I have an oops because I just dropped my phone, I want to be seen pretty much immediately. But on the other side, I'm the kind of person who likes scheduling things and who likes, you know, signing up in advance. And I don't want to be punished just because I had the forethought to actually register myself on the website.
Yeah, who wants to wait 30 minutes? It needs to be like a real-time operating system with deadlines, right? I can't go to the store for an undefined wait period. Like, I'm going to go get my thing. And it's like, how long will you be waiting? I don't know. I mean, because you could end up having to just abort the entire thing because an hour has passed and you haven't been seen. An appointment, like, as the Seinfeld episode so eloquently emphasized, like, you know, you make a reservation. And the important part of the reservation is that they hold the reservation for you. So that when you get there, they say, yes, we recognize that we had arranged previously to meet here at 3. And if you arrive at 3, then I'll be ready to receive you at 3. That's how reservations work. And I understand there's a balance. You don't want to just have reservations because then everybody walks in and like, sorry, you have to make a reservation. And the nearest reservation is, it's like going to a restaurant that you can't ever get a table at unless you have a reservation 2 months out or something. So it is difficult. And all this gets back to the discussion last week, which was one of the important functions of Apple Retail is to have a place where people can go to have someone help them with their thingy in person. It's one of the most important functions of the Apple Store. Otherwise, why not just sell everything online? It's that you can go there and say, my thing's not working. It's broken. I don't understand it. Please help me with it. Something, right? And they will help you. And they're great at it. They do a good job, and so on and so forth. And there's high demand for that service because that is a good service. High demand, not enough supply, long waits. And they try to balance it. Well, how many reservations should we take? If we take too few reservations, that means if you try to make a reservation, it'll have to be 2 weeks out. But if we take too many reservations, the walk-ins can't get served. I don't know what the solution to it is. I'm just expressing our frustration as users of the Apple Store with the system as it exists today. Maybe it's untenable and it's not economical for them to not make us wait. It is more economical to make us all wait for a small amount of time because honestly, what's the alternative, right? But that's, you know, it's just us as customers of the Apple Store expressing our dissatisfaction, because I think most of us, for the most part, buy things online rather than feeling like we have to go to the Apple Store to get it, especially if we wanted ASAP. We're there with the whole force quitting the App Store app, you know, all these schemes. We're not going to the mall at 5 a.m. and sitting in a big line. It's preferable for us to order them online. We do go there to check out products like, oh, I want to see the new iPhone 10. Mine hasn't arrived yet, but I hear they're in the stores. That's another important function of the stores. Show off the merchandise. Let people ooh and ah at it, especially particularly people who aren't like tech nerds and have already read everything about it, but just like regular people wandering through the mall, they can say, oh, there's the Apple Store. Let's go check out stuff. But yeah, I think it's even those functions, it's not serving that well because the stores are often very crowded. But the service function is the one that I feel like has had the most challenges over the years. So, you know, it's interesting to hear their strategies for improving it, but I don't think there are any easy answers.
Yeah, and also like the whole thing where like, oh, just show up and see how long you have to wait, like that really doesn't work for people if, for instance, the nearest Apple Store is 3 hours away.
And like, oh, yeah, great point.
Like, there's a lot of people for whom the nearest Apple Store is not just, you can't just pop over there anytime you want and just, oh, it's going to be 2 hours. Oh, I'll come back. Like, it's not that easy. You know, it's like, and so there's issues like that. And also just like, I mean, my experience, and maybe this is just, you know, my local stores, my experience has been the opposite, that I used to just never make appointments and just walk in because it used to be, you know, relatively common that I'd get seen within, you know, 20 minutes and it would be fine. And then in the last year or two, that's been pretty much impossible. And I walk in, they will either refuse to even book me as a walk-in, you know, wait around reservation, just say, sorry, we are so full that you can't even do this. Or they do a thing where they're like, oh, we'll, you know, sign up for this thing and then we'll text you when it's about to be your appointment time. But the current estimated time is like, you know, 2 hours away or something. And it's like, okay, well, so like, what am I going to do? Like, drive home and then, you know, it's going to take me 25, 30 minutes to get back here. So like, it's like, is that, am I going to miss my window? Like, that doesn't work for people, for a lot of people. Like, it works if you live next to an Apple Store and can just pop over there whenever you want and don't have a job and don't have anything else to do. Like, that would work. But for most people, something a little more predictable is what you need there. I will say, though, overall, we got way more feedback than I expected about the retail segment that we talked about last week. You know, we were talking about Angela Ahrens' retail update and things like that. And we must have a number of retail nerds in our audience because we got that of everything we said last week about everything about the event and all the new products that were announced, our complaints about the retail segment were by far the most controversial things we said according to the feedback. Like, we got so many people saying, like, well, this wasn't really for you. This was explaining to X, whether it was explaining to the world of retail how Apple is saving the dying American retail sector, or whether it's explaining to the retail employees how to boost their morale and what they're doing means a lot and everything. All sorts of feedback from people who either claim to be or were obviously very close to the retail world, saying why that segment not only needed to be there or needed to be that long and detailed, but what Angela Ahrens was really trying to say and why that was so important and everything. So I guess it mattered to, it resonated with somebody, with people who were in the retail business. I can just say, as an Apple customer and fan and commentator, it didn't resonate with me at all. But apparently it worked for a lot of people.
I don't know. A lot of the explanations were things like, you know, you don't understand how important Apple it is. They're like, they're keeping these malls alive, right? That's great. That's fine. But why does anyone need to be told that Apple stores are keeping malls alive? That's not a message that needs to get out. And I don't think that was in there. Like, they just wanted to tell you more things about their store. And I still am not sure who they were trying to convince of what, because I don't think they're trying to convince people that, you know, they're not trying to tell the rest of the retail industry how they should do things, because why would they help their competitors? And they're not trying to take credit for saving malls, because what the hell does Apple care about malls? I still think it is a lot of sort of deep thinking about what a store can be, when I wish they would think more about what their store already is and how it can do what it is doing better. And you know, that's why I put this feedback in here, because this is an Apple retail employee saying the things that you're asking for them to do, they are doing that, but they're also thinking big about how a store can be a town hall, whatever, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I thought it was a little overly long in a presentation that had some very important products to get to, came after two other segments, right? Maybe if it had been in the front, we would be complaining about whatever the third one was, right? Because it was a lot of lead-in before they got to the three big announcements, but in the grand scheme of things, it's, you know, it's not iCards. It was fine. iCards, no one remembers that. No one on this podcast anyway, but listeners remember.
Doubtful, but that's okay.
No, they totally do.
All right.
Please do not email and tweet us to say that you remember iCards.
Okay, time for some Ask ATP. That actually went quicker than I expected. I'm proud of us.
Really? An hour? That was quicker than I expected?
Given that we didn't have any follow-up last time, I am pretty pleased.
Okay.
Jamie Billett writes in to say, oh man, I should have taken this out of the show notes. I didn't look closely enough. Jamie Billett, my new enemy, writes in to say, if the new Mac Pro doesn't have NVIDIA, will it be a failed product? No. Moving on. Martin Deering writes in.
Why?
You got the answer right, though. I like the fact that you got the answer right. The answer is no, it won't be a failed product.
What does that even mean?
So this is how I interpret the question. I talked a lot about how NVIDIA is kind of at the top of the heap in GPUs currently, and the Mac Pro is supposed to be the fastest and bestest thing in the world, so shouldn't it have NVIDIA? And they're saying if it doesn't have that, if it has a lesser GPU, a GPU that is not as good, that is not as popular, that doesn't have as much software optimized for it, will it be a failed product? And the answer is no. The Mac Pro should be the best, fastest thing Apple can make. If for some strategic or stupid reason they want to go with AMD instead of NVIDIA, AMD makes some good graphics cards. If the Mac Pro is expandable, reliable, and frequently updated, it matters not as much that it has the fastest and best video card on the market, as long as the next year there's a new version with a better video card and so on and so forth. It would be a better product probably if it shipped with NVIDIA today. But I don't think it will be a failed product. The way it will fail is kind of like the trash can failed. If it is never updated, if it has reliability problems that are never addressed, if it doesn't address the needs of the customers that aren't fulfilled by, you know, the iMac Pro and stuff, that's what will make it a failed product, not the lack of NVIDIA.
And then Chris Adamson asks, hey, how is John liking the beta of Twitterific for the Mac, a.k.a. Phoenix? And he also asks, do the other two use native Twitter clients or the web? And Chris, I am deeply offended that you would think that I would use either the native Twitter client or the web, because they're both dumpster fires. Both Marco and I use Tweetbot.
Asterisk.
They say use native Twitter clients, not the native Twitter client. So you'd misinterpreted that question.
My apologies. Yes, it is. My apologies. Hooked on Phonics did not work for me. No, my apologies. But yes, I use Tweetbot. And apparently, Marco, you don't entirely use Tweetbot.
So I still use Tweetbot on the Mac. Earlier in the summertime, I deleted Tweetbot from my phone. I've tried various schemes and tricks over the years to reduce my Twitter usage because I have frequently been using Twitter too much, which has made me waste a lot of time and be less happy. I tried for a long time deleting it from the desktop and only using it on phones and tablets and laptops and stuff, so it was not on my main computer. And this made things like work difficult, because my work sometimes involves posting things to Twitter, like when I'm doing podcast live broadcasts and when I'm just asking questions about, you know, Apple APIs and stuff. And so that it was actually fairly difficult for me to not have it available to me on the desktop. It turns out, by deleting it from my phone, I do still have it available because I also have the official Twitter app installed. The official Twitter app I bury in a folder. I have to only get to it from search. And I find that it isn't very tempting to like just keep going to it over and over again, because the official Twitter app is so horrible that it actually discourages you from using it very much or for very long periods.
Hey, look, put that quote in their App Store description. Marco Arman. This app is so horrible, it will discourage you from using Twitter. Marco Arman.
It honestly is. Twitter's app is such a confusing, horrible mess of God knows what. And the way it messes up your timeline and puts like the, you know, important stuff you might have missed like up top, it actually is so hard to use for more than about 10 seconds that it totally kills my desire to continue to see it over and over again. And so by not having it be visible on any of my home screens, and also by having it be so awful, I still have Twitter if I want to like post a photo I just took while I'm out or something like that. And if I really need to check something or look something up, because honestly, sometimes you need to like look stuff up on Twitter and the website is really awful for that. So like I do occasionally have to check it for things. But that's like having the official Twitter app is enough to allow that, you know, those kind of basic occasional needs. But it's so bad, I don't want to use it constantly. And not having Twitter on my phone means that in the millions of other times throughout the day when I'm wasting a few seconds by reading my phone, and notably the significant times right before I go to sleep and the first thing I do when I wake up, if I'm not like taking care of a kid or a dog immediately, if I'm like lying in bed for a few minutes, or you know, like I'll read stuff on my phone like many of us do, not having Twitter be a part of either of those times and not having it be part of most of those little interactions throughout the day where I'm just checking stuff to like idly browse things or idly waste time has been a dramatic improvement in my happiness level, just generally of how I feel about life and what's going on in the country and crazy people who follow me and, you know, are occasionally, you know, rude and stuff like that. Like, it has given me an amount of distance from that I find incredibly satisfying and healthy. In a way that my previous experiments of trying to like delete it from my Mac and stuff didn't achieve. It's so pervasive on the phone. Like every time I picked up the phone, I would be checking Twitter as like one of the very first things I did. And now I check email, which is usually nothing because I have systematically destroyed the reason for most people to ever email me or the mechanism for them to do so over the last 10 years. So email is pretty quiet. RSS is there. I check that all the time in the Unread app, which is wonderful. And I check Instagram, which is happy because it's people posting pictures of fun things and happy things. And to not have Twitter be part of that, like that those apps that you just check habitually, has been really nice, and I highly recommend it. And to the people at Twitter who make the official app, just never get better.
Oh, my word. Yeah, I really should try that at some point.
One thing I would love to have, I mean, one of the things that kept drawing me to Twitter was that over the last few weeks, I've been having a number of interactions with people over direct messages. And so I'd have to like keep checking it to make sure I was up to date on those conversations or to respond to them. I was unable to find a Twitter client that only does direct messages. It seemed like one of them did exist. It doesn't exist anymore. Like, all the links were broken. It's not in the App Store anymore. If anybody knows of a good Twitter client that is DM only, I'd love to know about that.
That's an interesting idea.
We're going to answer my part of the question here before we move on, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
How do I like Phoenix? It's great. You should get it. It's totally what I always dreamed the modernized version of Twitter would be, and I love seeing the updates that are slowly adding, not slowly, but pretty quickly adding all the new features that were, you know, missing. First, you couldn't do direct messages, then you couldn't get info on the people, then you couldn't show threads, and it's just like they're all like one after the other. I love it. Everyone should check it out. It's great.
We are sponsored this week by Betterment. Rethink what your money can do. Visit betterment.com/ATP to learn more. Betterment is the largest independent online financial advisor designed to help you improve your long-term returns and lower your taxes for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment takes advanced investment strategies and uses technology to deliver them to more than 270,000 customers. They have low, transparent advisory fees compared to traditional services. There's only a 0.25% annual fee with unlimited messaging with their team of licensed financial experts. And if you have a more complex situation, Betterment Premium gives you unlimited phone time with their certified financial planners for only 0.4% annually. And Betterment's tax saving strategies help increase your after-tax returns. Everything they do is designed to lower your taxes and increase your returns. On average, the tax-coordinated portfolio can increase portfolio value by an estimated 15% over 30 years. And Betterment's technology helps make investing easier. Investing shouldn't be a confusing or frustrating experience. Betterment is built to make managing your wealth an easy and enjoyable experience. Investing involves risk. ATP listeners can get up to 1 year managed free. For more information, visit betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, rethink what your money can do.
There was some chatter about the Face ID training, which came through in part from the interview with a friend of the show, Matt Panzerino at TechCrunch. And just quoting Matt, he said, especially given that the data needed to include a high fidelity depth map of facial data, so says Federighi, Apple went out and got consent from subjects to provide scans that were, quote, quite exhaustive, quote. Those scans were taken from many angles and contained a lot of detail that was then used to train the Face ID system. As mentioned above, Apple went to great lengths to gather its own data on facial shapes and angles. And when it did, it made sure to gather them across a broad basis of geographic locations, ages, and ethnic backgrounds. Federighi says that Apple has tested extensively, and it should not matter what your cultural background is, Face ID should work with your face. So that was Matt Panzerino summarizing an interview with Craig Federighi. As I was reading this, it occurred to me, this sounds familiar. Where did I read this? And then I remembered. An anonymous listener wrote us on the 2nd of June, 2017. That listener wrote, I was lucky enough to participate in a study ran by the scientific consulting firm Exponent in a major U.S. city. The study was run in multiple U.S. cities and also multiple sites abroad. At my site, each day, about 70 or 80 participants, 6 days a week, for about two months, at least, so 3,000 to 4,000 people or thereabouts, were asked, or they were recruited, and that was both individuals and family groups. With family groups, they had to sign up two or more people related by blood. And this listener writes, this strongly suggests authentication. Obviously, you want to be able to differentiate between relatives who can look very similar. And they describe in quite a bit of detail what the test was, and it involves filling out a survey, talking about your skin tone and things like that. The consent form talks about how you're going to have an infrared laser shined at you. During the session, you're asked to use a device for a series of tasks, which according to the listener, was an iPhone 7 Plus with a heavy case-like attachment, blah, blah, blah. And then they talk about the different tasks, which I kind of want to read, but I'm trying to summarize this at least slightly. Also, they have you test for looking at the phone, looking away from the phone, using different kinds of lighting, different kinds of headwear with hats and scarves and sunglasses and masks, etc., and different background objects and so on and so forth. And each participant was given 10 variations, not the same 10, and there were many other tests involved. So I just thought this was fascinating. This is certainly within the realm of time where I think we thought Face ID was possible, but this was, you know, again, 3 months ago, three and change. And this is clearly, to me, describing what the Face ID test, or not test, but the Face ID like data acquisition process was all about. And I just thought that was fascinating.
Each person got $100 too. Not cheap to run this. If you think of how many thousands of people, and they had to pay the staff and then the building to have them all in, and then give each participant $100. Apple's got a lot of money.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought that was fascinating. There are more details which John isn't allowing me to tell you about, but they are there.
You can, if you can summarize them, find the interesting ones, find the interesting tidbits.
So the tasks they did, a task where the game was a game where dots appear randomly on the screen. You're asked to identify the emoji animals that pop up in the dots as they flash by, and they thought it was an eye tracking calibration. Task two, this had many variations, but the basic structure was the same. You're seated at an arc shaped white table with a white wall, more like a fabric surface, in front of you. The wall and table are both divided 2x3 or 3x3 grids by black lines with numbers in each partition. In each variation, you're asked to hold the phone up toward one partition of the grid as if taking a selfie, and then turn your head toward another partition. So sometimes you're facing the phone, sometimes you're not. You turn your eye to look at the phone or keep them straight, then press the record button on the phone, and then do an action with your face. Shake your head in a different way, cover your face, etc. And then the recording is done automatically. Who knows if this was really Apple, but certainly to my eyes, it seemed to be. And then that explains how they trained this, you know, because obviously Apple's a very diverse company. Well, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Apple is more diverse than some of the companies that I see. And there are more employees of various backgrounds there than a lot of companies. Let me try to phrase it that way. And so they could certainly, and I'm sure they did, train on internal people. But it seems like they also did a lot of work by seeking out other people, which is great. That's what I would hope. And this is the only report I've heard about this, and this was sent directly to ATP. I'm not saying that other reports don't exist, but it's the first I've heard.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this email a lot over the last couple of weeks as this Face ID thing was ramping up and then it was finally unveiled. And it's pretty cool. I assume this was real. I assume this was a true report that was not just some made up tip or anything. If so, it makes a lot of sense. It's totally plausible, and it's pretty cool that Apple went to such lengths, to try to get a lot of people's data for training and everything else. And all of this, as Craig has very happily pointed out over the last couple of interviews he's done, all of this is not being based on collecting data from the field from iPhone X. It's not reporting your face data back to Apple for it to improve its algorithms and train its machine learning. It's doing separate studies that people are explicitly opting into and being paid for to get its data and to train its models. And so it's just all it's pretty cool. It's really quite cool.
And it does learn from your face, but that information never leaves the phone, which is kind of a bummer if you get a new phone or get your front thing replaced because you cracked the screen or something. Basically, with Touch ID, it's going to mean that you have to retrain it on your face and it's going to start over with learning. So hopefully the learning curve isn't too bad. But that's their whole MO with this stuff, is that it's in the secure enclave. It never leaves it. And so if you break the front of your phone and they have to replace the thing that connects to the secure enclave, guess what? You got to re-register your face and start the learning over. But that's how it learns with your face as you age, as you slowly grow a beard. Hopefully as you put on scarves in the winter, you'll have the scarf not obscuring your whole face, and it'll figure out sometime the scarf is there. I don't know how good it's going to be in terms of, can you just put on a ski mask one day and have it still recognize you? But it does learn and improve just like Touch ID, by the way. Both these things do learn and improve just from you, and it's just between you, the phone, and the secure enclave. That's it.
Moving on, we should probably dive back into the iPhone announcement or the keynote from last week. And we have a little bit of information about the Apple Watch. Our Apple Watches are due to arrive potentially as listeners are hearing this. The cellular watch has 16 gigs of storage, and the non-cellular watch has 8 gigs. And at first glance, that seems kind of weird, right? Because the cellular watch can stream things, but the non-cellular watch can't. So you would think you would want more storage on the non-cellular watch. But everyone seems to agree, and I guess it makes sense, that you're going to want to cache the things that you've streamed, and so maybe having more space does make sense on the cellular watch.
Just waiting for someone on the watch team to write in and tell us, no, that extra space isn't used for caching.
No, yeah, it'll be from an online chat support agent. No, I mean, that actually, so it makes some sense. First of all, the cellular model is $70 more, so they have a little bit more leeway in the margins. But also, a cellular watch is more likely to be used as a standalone music playback device than a non-cellular watch, because somebody who's going to go seek out and buy the cellular one probably intends to use it as a workout device, wirelessly with music playing. The chances of that being used for that purpose are way higher than other watch models. And if you're going to go take a run with the watch, one way you could do that, technically with music, is to literally stream the audio off the internet. Another way you could do it is the cellular should only be used very, very sparingly. And the watch can be smart and just cache things from Apple Music that you like or that you've selected to be available on your runs. And Apple Music, based on recommendations and algorithms and everything else, it knows before you go out running what you should probably be listening to. So it probably buffers that stuff like overnight or something when it's plugged in and when it's charging. It probably tries to fill as much space as it can, you know, with downloaded music that it can then play for you without touching the cell network at all. Because then it saves data, it saves a ton of battery life. And it works with intermittent connectivity areas. Like, what if you're running under, you know, between buildings in New York City, and you know the cell connection would keep dropping or whatever else. Like, it has cellular, yes, but that doesn't mean Apple is going to use it aggressively, because it, from all the reviews that have come out today, it looks like it has a tremendous cost to battery life. And that, you know, even if like this alleged Wi-Fi bug that they're saying is causing some of the connectivity problems that some of the reviewers had, even if that is fixed shortly, you know, because it probably will be, it does seem like the LTE connection of the watch is not very aggressive about staying connected. Like, it seems like it only connects if like it really needs to. And so if they have enough space on the watch to buffer a whole bunch of music before you go for a run, why would you stream it? Like, why wouldn't you just play your buffer? And then if you run out of buffer, then maybe stream some stuff. But why burn the battery when you don't have to?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Actually, real-time follow-up on the watch. Jason Snell has communicated with me via the magic of Slack and told me that what you just said, Marco, is absolutely correct, that the watch does use some of those like fancy pants Apple Music playlists and caches those overnight, in addition to some of the music that it knows you like, and it tries to suck those in, at least on the cellular models, suck those in overnight while it's charging when you're not on...
They said that in the keynote, which is why you had that vague memory of it. That's where it's from.
Oh, well, now I learned. The iPhone, I thought a couple of interesting things, which I don't think were noticed or noted in the keynote. First of all, it includes the little headphone adapter, the Lightning to, what is it, TLDR, whatever it's called.
TRRS.
Yeah, TRRS.
TLDR adapter.
Yeah, as soon as I said that, I was like, oh no, I do remember. Anyway, it does include the adapter, which I would say I lost a bet with myself. I thought it would be included in the 7 and never again. And I understand that not everyone upgrades every year, so it makes sense for it to still be there. But I'd expected Apple to be kind of aggressive about getting rid of it. And they weren't, which is a good thing, I'd say. But it was surprising. And then additionally, there are no USB-C cables of any sort included in the iPhone box, no sort of adapter, no cable, nothing like that, which I can't decide if I think that that's totally bananas or makes perfect sense. And I think I'm ever so slightly leaning toward that makes perfect sense, even though it is weird that none of their brand new computers or laptops, I should say, can plug into an iPhone without some sort of an adapter. I don't know. Marco, what do you think about that? Is that weird or is that make sense?
I mean, it sucks that we don't have an all USB-C world, but the fact is we don't have an all USB-C world. So if they would include the USB-C power adapter or USB cable in the box as the only one, then you would have the issue of, like, you know, you can't plug it into pretty much anything that people use to charge their phones. Yes, people do often charge their phones by plugging them into their computers, but they charge them way more often by plugging them into other things, power adapters, docks, USB outlets, other USB multi-port things. Like, and none of those things really are USB-C yet, like, practically speaking. So if there's going to be only one cable in the box, I still think it makes sense for it to be the USB-A cable. Now, you could also argue, as some people have, that they should just put two cables in the box, you know, put a USB-C and a USB-A cable. And that would be interesting. I think the Apple's argument against that, there would be a small reason to not do it for the sake of margins to be able to sell $25 cables to the people who want this function. But I think their bigger argument would be that would be very wasteful. That, like, almost everybody, by definition, or almost everybody who got an iPhone would not use that second cable. They would almost certainly only use one of those. So it would be kind of wasteful to have, like, a cable in the box that almost everyone's throwing away. That doesn't make it great. This is still an annoying problem, but I think the other solutions to it would probably be worse. While we're on the topic of the iPhone and its ports and its cables, I would also just like to suggest the idea here officially that I bet the Lightning port is gone within 5 years. And because now, you know, now we're going to have wireless charging. We have it now. It's not as fast as everything else yet. It's going to get faster, and it's going to get fast enough that I would bet that the newest iPhone that comes out in 5 years, whatever model that is, does not have a Lightning port and has no replacement for the Lightning port. Just it's just gone, you know, because they're going to deem it unnecessary. So I would say for people out there, I would hesitate to invest heavily in Lightning-based hardware. Cheap things like cables, that's fine. But like, for instance, there are now super fancy Lightning headphones from, you know, brands like Audacy, like high-end audiophile headphone brands. For many reasons, I would never suggest anybody waste money on those. Number one, they sound terrible. But numbers like 2 through 7, like, you know, you can't use them with anything else ever. And also, Lightning ports are not long for this world. Now that we have Bluetooth everything, and now that we have wireless charging, I would not depend on Lightning being around for a long time. 5 years might even be comically conservative. I would think that there's a good chance it's gone in 3 years.
I think it's going to take a little bit longer than you think. I mean, obviously, they have to march towards the sort of platonic ideal of just like a screen, this little skinny magic thing, you know, right? Or you know, it becomes a little tiny nodule and everything is all in glasses in VR, right? So on an infinite time scale, yes, Lightning port is going away. I just don't know what the timing is like because getting rid of ports is all well and good until it's the last one, and then it's a little bit harder to get rid of. I think usage, you've got everything covered, but I was just thinking like, oh, they get rid of the Lightning port. But of course, there's a USB-C port for diagnostics in the back, like on the mouse where you stab it in there. Right? Sometimes there's no substitute for making electrical contact for extraordinary situations. And I'm wondering what their solution to that would be. Maybe just like two regions on the back that essentially act as contacts for doing diagnostic things. And really what I'm trying to get at is the Lightning port the last port that'll ever be on there, or does Lightning port get replaced with some other port which eventually goes away? But yeah, in our lifetime, there will be no wire that you plug into the phone thing, because we're almost there now where there doesn't have to be, and it's just a question of, you know, waiting for the whole world to catch up with it.
I would say not just in our lifetime. I would say probably within my 4K Apple TV's lifetime.
I mean, 5 years was my prediction for the notch going away. Although on that topic about the notch and more like predictions on timelines, as I said at the end of the thing, 5 years is when I think they could get rid of it. But if it becomes a powerful branding thing, as we discussed, like, you know, why would they do the notch and why does the icon of it show the notch and like, how is this one differentiated or whatever? It could last longer, not forever, because even the things that distinguish, like, you know, the click wheel distinguished the iPod, and that silhouette with the click wheel was really important. But when it was time for that to go away, it did, right? They didn't say, but that's how we brand the iPods. Like, they had no problem making an iPod Touch without a click wheel because they realized the future is not this little screen and a wheel. The future is all screen, right? So they may hold on to the notch longer for branding reasons. There's no such reason to hold on to the Lightning cable. And technically speaking, they're way closer to being able to get rid of it because all the pieces are pretty much already there. It's just a question of conservatism, like when do they think they can get rid of it? I think they pushed a little bit on the headphone, which is why they're still shipping an adapter. Lightning, I don't know. Your 5 year thing seems reasonable to me. Your 3 year thing seems a little bit aggressive, but who knows?
Also, there's an interesting question in the chat room from Yonatron saying, "Do you think after Lightning is gone from the phone, will/should they switch to USB-C on the iPad?" And that's an interesting question. You know, I feel like it depends a lot on, like, you know, what are these ports actually used for and what could they be used for? On the iPad, you know, it has had the ability to plug in a limited set of USB peripherals since day one. You know, like since the very first iPad, it had that camera connection kit, and there was one that has like little USB port on it, and there still is. You know, they updated it with Lightning, and there was a new one last year that had power pass through finally, which is awesome. So like, and that USB port over the years has worked for not any USB device, but, you know, things like standard HID compliant keyboards. That's probably one of the biggest uses for it. Also, network adapters would work over it, so you could have like Ethernet wired on. It has always worked for sound devices, which is very, very nice during sound production. And I don't think there's a wireless equivalent to things like a microphone interface. Like, I don't think that anybody makes Bluetooth audio input devices. At least they shouldn't, and I hope they don't, but they probably do. But nobody should do that. But so, like, there are these kind of edge case things that, like, having a port at all, and even if it requires crazy adapters or specialized hardware to use it for these kind of purposes, having a port that can be adapted to these kind of weird edge cases does allow these devices to be used in some pretty creative ways in some pretty interesting fields, and that having no port at all, relying totally on wireless, would make some of those things harder. However, I think those limits are more important to keep open on the iPad than on the phone. That's why I think, like, the phone is probably going to get rid of Lightning first, and probably fairly soon, relatively speaking. The iPad, it would, because of those edge case uses, I think it would be more destructive to lose its only port in that way. But it also doesn't really matter what that port is. We've argued for years, like, why don't they add a couple of USB ports to it? So far, the iPad has done seemingly pretty well and totally fine, having its own proprietary port that, could be adapted to a couple things here and there, but for the most part was not a standard port. And I don't see that demand curve in that way changing much over time. Like, it got this far with no standard ports, and it's going to keep going with no standard ports. But I do think it would be a shame if it lost the one that it has.
No, it needs more ports. Like, for the 24-inch iPad Pro, right? That's when you start. Like, you don't need the Lightning port. You can get rid of the Lightning port, but it should have 5 USB-C ports. Like, for the big Pro version, for the one, for the Surface Book type of, is that what the, am I getting the name right of the iMac-y?
I can't even keep track of the
27-inch screen. Like, I still think that's lurking out there in the future of the iPad as it becomes more and more capable and as they expand the line. So if and when that day comes, that's the time when the iPad needs ports, because it is essentially going to, it's taking the mantle of the PC and the laptop. Surface Studio is apparently the drafting table thing or whatever. It's ridiculous to have a 27-inch tablet-sized thing that you use only at your desk because it's huge that has one port on one edge. That's ridiculous, right? So Lightning go away. But whatever the equivalent of USB-C, a Thunderbolt, or whatever, should be there for all the reasons that we hook things up to our PCs today, right? And they're not all going away quite as rapidly as we feel like we could be ditching them on the phone, because so many things. Apple itself has come up with so many of the solutions, like with the AirPods, with wireless charging, getting rid of syncing and backing up to your Mac. Like, they're practically there, but it's too early for them to do it, if only because charging would take too long, because the Qi charging is very slow now, supposedly going to get a little bit faster, but it's probably not going to catch wire for a while yet.
Well, but that's also, like, we don't have Apples yet. Like, we only have the existing ones that are out there. Once Apple ships their version of the Qi charging mat, which I hope is soon. I'm kind of sad that it isn't until next year. But once they ship that, before the iPad came out, USB charging was very, very slow. And the iPad was one of the first devices, if not the first device, to use, like, higher amperage USB charging standards. And I don't even know if it was a standard back then, or if Apple just kind of hacked it on there. But they needed more power, so they made their custom power brick that delivered these, the more power over USB to the iPad that needed it. Maybe this is a similar kind of thing, where, like, all the existing things out there now are these low-power things, but, Apple is doing their magic with extending the standards and pressuring the standards bodies and manufacturers of things. So maybe maybe next year's Qi charging mats are going to be pretty fast.
Speaking of, can one of you explain to me what is the equipment I need to do fast charging with the iPhones 8 and iPhone 10? And my understanding from looking at some of Gruber's recent work is that it's actually not that fast, but what are the components I need? And can we get links for these for the show notes? Because I'm not trying to be funny. I genuinely am not clear on what stuff I need in order to make this work.
All right. So the official answer is you should not be asking us unprepared on a podcast. You should just search for some article that Serenity Caldwell has probably written at iMore that tells us all the actual information. But But in, off the top of my head, you know, so you need basically a USB-C power brick. So not an iPad brick. All of those do charge. If you have any iPhone past, I believe they started with the 6 or the 6S. Anything that, you know, then or newer will charge faster from an iPad power brick or any other 2.4 amp USB power device. So if you aren't using one of those yet, please use those for everything. Your phones will charge noticeably faster. But if you want to go even faster than that, but not too much faster than that, you can now use, with the new iPhones, you can now use a USB-C power delivery brick. So either the bricks that came with all the new MacBooks and MacBook Pros, including your little MacBook, Casey, that should do it, I believe. And then you need a USB-C to Lightning cable. I think there's only one type of USB-C to Lightning cable, I hope, from Apple. Because there's been, previously, the USB-C to C cables, there were actually multiple different Apple USB-C to C cables with different power delivery abilities. And I assume that's all legacy and that has been solved in current inventory that they'd have like in an Apple store, but that was a problem before. But with C to Lightning, I think there's only ever been one. So if you have Apple's, at least, I'm not sure I would trust a third-party cable for this just yet, just because, you know, not that it would like catch fire or anything, but I would just be wary of whether it would work at the maximum rate or not. So I would say go get the Apple Lightning to USB-C cable and plug it into your MacBook's power brick. That's the answer.
Cool. All right, thanks, because I was very confused.
You could also use the Anchor, you know, your little like 5-port thing that charges things that you told us all to buy in that awesome blog post?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ended up this past winter, I bought the version of that that has a single USB-C output port as well that can power up to, I think, 60 watts over it or something like that. That's wonderful, by the way. So, you know, like if you're bringing a new MacBook of any kind on a trip and you want to just bring one charger, that Anchor thing that has one USB-C port and like 4 USB ports is awesome. And can totally power all of the new laptops. It doesn't fully power the 15-inch if you're like super draining it, because it's, you know, 60, I think, versus 85 watts or 87 watts, whatever it is. But it's good enough for almost everything. But again, the gains here in speed, like as some of the reviewers are noting, the gains are not that fast. Like it isn't that much faster than just using an iPad power brick or any other 2.4 amp source. So I would say, you know, if you already have this hardware, great, but I'm not sure it's worth the total investment between the bricks and the cables if you're only buying these things to do faster iPhone charging. I think you might be disappointed in how much faster it isn't.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you clearing that up. All right. AirPower, we spoke about that a little bit just a minute ago. One thing that bummed me out about AirPower, which is the pad and technology that allows the one pad to charge multiple Apple devices, what about nightstand mode on the watch? So if you leave the watch on a charger and you leave it such that the buttons are at the top, then when you jostle the watch even the littlest bit, it will show you the time, just like a clock would on your nightstand. And it'll let you like pause and perhaps stop alarms by pressing the physical buttons, just like a clock on your nightstand. And I use this every night, and I love it. And, I mean, this is the firstest world problem, but I'm going to be kind of bummed if I can't do that on this like air power charging mat. And this occurred to me in part because I have the dock that Studio Neat makes. I forget exactly what it's called. We'll put a link in the show notes, but that is designed in many ways specifically for this. And they actually talked about this on an episode of their podcast called Thoroughly Considered. And to be honest, I listened to it days ago and forgot exactly what they said, but in some way they discussed it and I forget what conclusion they came to, but this kind of bums me out. I mean, Marco, you don't believe in the Apple Watch. John, you don't really either, so never mind.
By the way, I use it like every day, but I just don't use it the same way you do.
Fair enough. But do you use it? Where do you charge it at night? Do you charge it like at your desk, or do you charge it on your nightstand?
It's at my desk, so it's not on my nightstand. But when I was wearing it full time as like my main watch, I was charging it on my desk. But that predated nightstand mode. But yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I just did the lowest tech solution here possible, which is I have like a regular alarm clock thing on my nightstand. they still make those, allegedly, apparently. Like, I just bought it like last year. You are able to buy regular alarm clocks. And but you know what most people do, I think, is, you know, either use their watch that way or just use their phone that way. It is a valid question then, if you're using a charging mat, like, what about using your phone as a clock? But I think the answer most people will have is they'll just pick it up if they want to check the time. Like,
yeah,
it isn't as nice, you know, as doing it your way, but you know, it works.
I've been thinking for years about what I would like in a nightstand clock, because I have iOS devices on my nightstand, as I think most of us do. My phone charges there. My iPad actually charges there as well. But I don't want to use them as... I have actually a dedicated, like, you know, old-style clock radio thing, which I don't like. It's ancient and huge and ridiculous and, you know... but it still works, and it has properties that Marco can relate to. When I turn my head in that direction, I can see the time, because it glows with just the right amount of glowiness, not blinding super bright, but not super dim. The letters are big, so with my blind nighttime eyes, without my glasses on, I can see them. And every time I look at it, it's there. I don't need to grope over on my nightstand, knocking over, you know, stuff that's over there. Like, I don't need to do anything. I don't need to touch anything. I don't need to jostle anything. I just look at it, and it tells me the time. And it also, it's what I use for my alarm. Why don't I want to use my watch or my phone or my iPad or any of the other umpteen things? Why don't I want to use them? Because they're not 100% guaranteed to be on my nightstand. What if I leave my phone downstairs? What if I leave my iPad downstairs? These devices are all over my house. I don't want to have to remember. I never have to remember. Did you remember to put the thing that's going to wake you up in the morning on your nightstand? It's always there. The alarm is always on. It goes on every time in the morning. And when I grope in the morning to turn off the alarm, I like big, chunky physical buttons that I can find, again, in my groggy state, and either snooze or turn off the alarm. It's not ideal. Like, the buttons are a little bit weird, but, you know, I've had this clock radio for like 20-something years now or whatever. I was thinking, like, a nice dedicated clock radio, and I was like, maybe Apple should make a nice dedicated. They're never going to do that, right? They want us to use our phone or our watch, but it's kind of like the bike thing. I just want a good one. And I've looked at a lot of them, and there's all sorts of fancy ones that are interesting, and sometimes they're really expensive, and sometimes they're double as Bluetooth speakers, which is kind of neat, but whatever. But and I also thought about, if I got a fancy one, I'd want to be able to, like, play a recording of my choosing. And I would just record my old clock radio's little beep beep sound, right? Because the sound you wake up to can be very, very personal. Like, some sounds people find very jarring and frightening to wake up to, and others, you know, comforting, and some sounds just don't wake them up at all. So maybe I should just keep this one forever, because it's obviously never going to break, but it does take up a lot of space in my nightstand. But anyway, all this is to say that all of Apple's efforts with nightstand mode and with this charging mat and everything seem to me to all be suboptimal solutions for the role that the clock radio plays. Maybe great solutions for what we're all doing with our devices now, which is charging them on your nightstand when you go to bed. But I am still looking for a solution to waking me up in the morning reliably without me having to remember not to leave my phone downstairs.
All right, I have a solution for you. It doesn't have an alarm.
How is this a solution?
It doesn't have an alarm.
Is it a butler?
It can't play the song of your choosing. However, it will always be charged because it's powered by air temperature changes. It is not designed by Apple, but it is designed by Mark Newson, who works for Apple.
Oh, right. Until you got the Mark Newson part, I said that sounds like my wife, because she's powered by air temperature changes. It's too hot in here. Wake up.
It only costs $26,800, the JLC Atmos clock. It is powered by atmospheric air temperature changes.
I would knock that off of my nightstand, and it would shatter to the ground, wasting $26,000 very quickly.
They're surprisingly heavy. I do not own one of these, but I have seen them in stores. They are quite remarkable to look at, and some of the lower end models can be had for only about $10,000.
So it used to be that my kids woke me up, and now they're all older. Now, realistically speaking, my dog wakes me up at 5:30 in the morning. The problem with the dog waking me up is if I'm not the one who goes and lets her out, I can fall back asleep, and that's a dangerous situation to be in. So I still do need my alarm. Most of the time, you know, I am the one who takes the dog out, and so then I do wake up. But I figure eventually the dog will this ever happen? Will the 7-month-old dog stop whining to be let out at 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning? I don't know. Hope springs eternal. But anyway, I still think the role of the thing that wakes you up in the morning is not a solved problem as far as I'm concerned. And iOS devices, including the watch, don't solve that for me, because I don't wear the watch when I sleep. Or at all. One more thing on Air Power about Apple's naming. It's kind of a weird name to me because Air Power means a thing in a military context. And I don't think, what other contexts are there for Air Power? There is the, I'm just making this phrase that has never been seen before, combining the word air with the word power, and isn't that great? But unfortunately, it is a phrase. Air Power is a thing. And it's weird to see an even vaguely military term on an Apple product.
That's interesting. I wonder if they even thought about that. That might not have occurred to them because they're so non-military thinking usually.
They thought of it and they just said, well, that's, no one knows that term. Only, you know, most people will see it and read it as they intend, which is air, which is like the MacBook Air. And then power, they probably said there are military connotations, but most people won't think of it that way. So it's fine. And they went with it. It just struck me as odd when they said it.
It is kind of funny also that the power does not go through the air, really.
What does it go through?
I mean, technically, there's probably a few air molecules between your phone and the mat, but
more than a few.
Yeah, but really, you know, it's not going through a lot of air.
It's not going through a wire now, is it? Oh, let's not get into that.
Please don't email us about that. You see, Google just bought part of HTC's Pixel division or something.
I've been hearing those rumors, and as someone tweeted about it, tell me how this is going to end up differently than it did with Motorola. I guess HTC doesn't have as many patents and they're not paying $12 billion for it.
Yeah, and how well it worked out for Microsoft with Nokia also. I mean, I think this is I'd be surprised if this mattered at all for anything ever.
Google just wants someone to make phones for them. Maybe Apple will do it.
Yeah, right.
That'll fix it. All right. Apparently, we have more to say about Animoji. Didn't we already talk about this?
We should wait until you can't use it with we can't use it with iOS 11 unless you have the 10, or does it work on the 8?
No, I don't think so, because it uses the fancy pants facial recognition stuff. I think it's only on the 10.
We should save it until one of us has it, I guess.
Yeah, so next March.
Yeah. Did you see, by the way, that apparently they're doubling down on the supply constraints? Like, MacRumors posted something earlier about how the supply constraint is really, really bad, and they haven't even started full-on Mac manufacturing.
We're waiting a while for our 10s.
Yeah, I expect it to be incredibly difficult for anybody to actually buy these phones, at least at list price, or anywhere near list price, until after December.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I haven't heard anything more than, you know, what these rumor sites have published, but just, you know, knowing how Apple has done these launches of recent products in the past, they frequently have trouble meeting demand recently, especially when it comes to very highly demanded iPhones. And this is probably going to be a whole other level of the disconnect between supply and demand for this one. So this is just going to be a mess, I think. I would be shocked if you could walk into a store and just buy one without having, you know, reserved it or anything before January, and maybe even later than that.
Yeah, I'm going to be a sad panda when this phone doesn't come in for a long time. Oh, man. The struggle is real, you guys. All right.
We can always go to the store and play with them, which will be all I'm doing because I'm not ordering one.
Of course.
Before we wrap this up, we should be done here because we're gone a little bit long. Real-time follow-up on Apple TV. Someone has sent me a screenshot of the screen where you can pick the screen resolutions. And so it does show a bunch of 24 hertz options. It shows 25 hertz SDR, 24 hertz HDR. I mean, I suppose it depends on what TV you're hooked up to and what things it supports. But these look like you choosing the output format, period, for the whole thing. So if you do pick 24 hertz, you're picking it for the whole UI. And I understand Apple's desire not to switch modes and that being flaky and stuff like that, but this isn't a great solution either because this, I mean, I guess most people will never go into the screen, but if you want to do the right thing, you will have to know the frame rate of the media you want to see, switch your Apple TV for a refresh rate to match the frame rate of the media you want to play, then go play the media, and then remember that you did that so that the next time you go watch a 30 FPS TV show or whatever, that you keep, you know, that you change to 60 hertz, or I don't know. I find it confusing, and I really wish the media player could just do the thing that other things attached to your television do and tell it, hey, I'm about to start playing 24 frames per second content, please switch to a refresh rate that is some multiple of 24 that I have detected using the magic of HDMI. So I'll try all this out when I get my Apple TV. I didn't get my order in very quickly, so I think mine's not going to be here for a week or two, but I'll let you know.
All right. Thanks to our three sponsors this week, Betterment, Fracture, and Aftershocks. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
I have a bit of real-time follow-up as well. During the show, not only have I installed the version of Safari that John told me I could install, and so now I guess I'm not seeing autoplay video anymore, and now I have 60% of the features of High Sierra without breaking the window manager. But also, there is indeed a Twitter direct message-only app called Twim, T-W-I-M. I installed it, and it does seem to work in the sense that I can get direct messages there. I've tested it during the show with Casey. Thank you, Casey. The only thing is it was not able to notify me of them, even though I enabled them. So I'm guessing it just like has to rely on background refresh and not just like a push service. And if so, that's kind of unfortunate in the sense that you might not get the messages for a while. But honestly, I don't really care that much most of the time about that if I'm on my phone and not browsing Twitter. So that seems all right to me. So yeah, thanks for everybody who recommended Twim.
That's cool.
There was an element here about Waze in our notes. Did you want me to expand on my use of Waze and how much I love it?
No, save it. That's all. These are all topic worthy topics.
That's not. It's not. It really isn't.
It totally is.
Oh my god.
We should go up to the after show section and ask Casey about how driving an Acura TRLX was, or he was in an Acura TRLX.
Yeah. So.
Wait, what is this one? Is this like the an SUV? Is this a...
No, it's an Accord, but gussied up a bit. And
it's not even on the Accord platform anymore.
Like
is
a
it?
Deluxe TL?
TLX, the TSX used to be on the European Accord platform. I don't know what platform the TLX on is, but I think it's not the Accord platform.
Whatever. It's the sedan that's, to John's point, it's probably a little bigger than an Accord, and it's certainly fancier.
It's not bigger than an Accord.
Oh, my God, John. Okay, how would you describe the TLX?
The website describes it as a 2018 restyled performance sedan.
It is. I don't know about performance sedan, but whatever. It doesn't matter. Anyway. So a coworker of mine has been test driving pretty much every car under the sun, trying to figure out what he wants to buy. And he's in that stage where he really wants to buy something frivolous and stupid, but he just turned 40 and is trying to convince himself that he shouldn't spend frivolous and stupid money. And also he should probably be more responsible. So one of the cars that he test drove that I sat in and went for literally like a 300-yard trip in was an Acura TLX. And so I would describe the Acura TLX as something Accord-ish and fancier. And the thing that's interesting about the Acura TLX is that it has two screens in it. There's a screen that's kind of far away on the dashboard that has navigation on it. And then there's a different screen in the center, not the center console, but like where the radio is, that and one of which has CarPlay and one of which doesn't. And if I recall correctly, the CarPlay one is the one, God, I'm going to get this wrong and I'm going to hate myself, but I think it was the one that was up high that does not offer a touchscreen. It has instead an iDrive-like cursor setup, or like a left, right, you know, up, down with enter sort of setup. And then the other screen that's down low is a touchscreen, and it was all really, really, really weird. And I don't think I liked it. But the most startling thing of all for me was, even after on a previous podcast, which was called Neutral, which none of you have ever heard of, I discussed that I thought the idea of a touchscreen for car infotainment was terrible. And I still mostly agree with that. in no small part because as you're driving down the road trying to mash your finger into the touchscreen, you go over the smallest bump, and that gets amplified over the distance of your arm and makes it impossible to stab what you want to hit on the screen. But seeing the like up, down, left, right setup in the Acura, that was much, much, much worse. And I want to see sometime if the BMW setup for a CarPlay allows you to use the iDrive spinner. And I want to see if that's any good. Or actually, Marco, have you ever tried that in Tiff's car?
Yeah, I have. And it's, well, I mean, so the way it's integrated into BMWs, and this is, so she has, I believe what their newest or close enough version is. So it's wireless. It works over Bluetooth, which is awesome. But the way BMW integrated it, and I guess in a lot of this, I feel like is unavoidable. They have their own whole system, their whole iDrive system, of course. So like they have their own navigation, their own media control and everything else. And they try to integrate CarPlay. And what the way it works is basically like CarPlay is like just one of the different layers or like app sections in iDrive that itself has like, you know, CarPlay's own like sub apps and stuff within it. So you can have like, you know, view CarPlay mode. And when you have a CarPlay connected phone, it's kind of is always available, but it's kind of hard to navigate to and find. Honestly, I find it very clunky. And maybe it's just because I don't usually drive Tiff's car, so I haven't really had a lot of time to get used to it. But I honestly really don't like using CarPlay in a car that has its own system that it's also trying to mix in or that it defaults to. I find the whole thing honestly very confusing. I will say the idea of navigating it via, you know, the wheel and stuff as opposed to a touchscreen, that part I haven't found to be too egregiously confusing or bad. That part seems to be fine. You know, with a car, you have very tricky ergonomics where you want, like, ideally you want the screens that the driver has to see to be pretty high up and to be set pretty deeply into the like windshield area. Just so you don't have to keep focusing your eyes that close to and from, you know, close and far away, and you don't have to look down too far. So if a screen is ideally positioned for the driver to see it frequently or safely or everything else, it's probably going to be a little hard to reach for it to be a touchscreen. So I see why they do this. Like, it makes sense to have a screen that is not a touchscreen that is, you know, far away for reaching but nice for looking. And then, you know, to have some kind of, you know, wheel or stick or something that you can control to move on screen. So I'm totally sold on not being a touchscreen. I am not, however, totally sold on CarPlay as an additional layer or mode of an already complex entertainment system and navigation system. That, I think, is very confusing and doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this. So Aaron's XC90, it has CarPlay. It is not wireless, which is a bummer. And I definitely have mixed feelings about it. And I think the reason that I was so persnickety about her getting a car that had CarPlay is because I want to future-proof it. Because if you look at the interface on my BMW, which was built in 2010 as a 2011 model year, you know, six, seven years on now, it looks pretty dated. Where by comparison, it stands to reason, maybe, that CarPlay will advance with time. And sure, yes, some auto manufacturers let you upgrade your firmware in your car or whatever. Sometimes you can do it yourself. Other times you can go to service and have it done. But more often than not, it's a whole new set of hardware to get you to the next version of say, iDrive. Like, I cannot get any of the latest and greatest iDrive because I would need brand new hardware. But with CarPlay, it's just a screen. That's all it is. And as long as the screen hardware doesn't need to change in future versions of CarPlay, it will always be the best CarPlay that will ever be. And this is also particularly important with maps because, although generally speaking, I can use the navigation of my car pretty well, and it typically knows where I'm going when I plug in an address, there are certainly like newer neighborhoods or newer sections of town where it has no clue where I'm going because the maps are 7 years old, and that's frustrating. And so I stand by CarPlay, if nothing else, as an insurance policy against future, what's the word I'm looking for, but when things just get old and busted in the future. And that's why I wanted it in Aaron's car so bad, and that's why I insisted on it. I'll also say that I happened to take her car out tonight to do a couple errands, And it's pretty sweet to be able to just plug in my phone and have it kind of take over, in the case of the Volvo, half the screen, because I don't need to have my phone paired with her car. And I don't need, it doesn't need to like fight with her phone when we're both in the car for who is going to be the more important phone. But yet when I plug it in via the cable, it becomes the only phone that matters, which is cool too. The thing that sucks about all this though, and now I'm kind of jumping ahead into next week's show, is Apple doesn't, or from what I can tell, Apple doesn't allow any sort of navigation system on CarPlay except Apple Maps. And I actually don't mind Apple Maps. I feel kind of the same way about Apple Maps as I do about the Apple TV remote. It's fine. But that being said, I would prefer, given the choice, to have, I don't know, maybe Waze on CarPlay. That would be neat. And that's not allowed, and it's because Apple is obnoxious like every other corporation is and won't allow it. And that's super-duper frustrating.
Real-time follow-up. Now that I look at this thing, the TLX is a replacement for the TSX and the TL. The TSX was small, originally based on the European Accord platform, and the TL was their bigger thing. This looks like it's like the size of the TL, so I think it actually might be the Accord platform. And that dual screen thing... That's a Honda thing. It's been in Accords for many generations now. I don't know how many Acuras it's been in. I don't know why they decided to do it. My car essentially has it, except that when I bought it, I didn't even have the choice to get the second screen. So I've got the one big screen that's not a touch screen buried in the dash. And where the second screen would be, I have comically oversized physical buttons to cover the giant square where the screen was supposed to be, which is very silly. My wife's Accord doesn't have it either. That's where the navigation would go if we had navigation in our car. But this is the new, what you're looking at, if you're looking at the 2018, this is the new improved Honda infotainment system, believe it or not. I have the even crappier one, but in some respects it is simpler because it doesn't do all that fancy CarPlay or Android stuff. It's just a terrible classic Honda interface.
To that end, the screen up top, which shows CarPlay in the picture that we'll put in the show notes, that screen, the navigation system, I shouldn't say it's a screen, I'm implying it's the hardware, it's not the hardware. The navigation system, though, that Honda has caked into this 2018 TLX looks like it's the navigation system from my 2010, well, really model year 2011 BMW. Like, it is approximately a 200 by 200 pixel screen from the looks of it. Now, the reality is it's not. It's better than that because CarPlay requires something better than that. But it is just so, it looks so antiquated and terrible. Oh my goodness, it looks terrible. And so if I had a TLX, there is zero chance I would ever look at that navigation because I would always, always, always be looking at CarPlay. Now in Tiff's car, where the navigation looks great and is performant and responsive and whatnot, I would probably do the exact same thing it sounds like Marco and Tiff do, which is, generally speaking, I would just use the onboard stuff. And in a pinch, if there was some particular reason to use CarPlay, then sure, I'll use CarPlay.
I mean, now we just use Waze, but we can't talk about that apparently until next week.
That's right.
You know what makes me mad about the TLX? It isn't the dual screens. It isn't the infotainment system. It's that this car is offered with a DCT. That's awesome.
No, it's not awesome because this car is not. It is not a sporty sedan. It's like I said. It's trying to be. The TSX was supposed to be porty, and the TL was supposed to be luxurious, and they combined them to make one bland car.
But this is like, it's a fairly accessibly priced car relative to other like sports cars, and it has a DCT option, and an all-wheel drive option, and a V6 almost 300 horsepower option. However, you can only get the DCT on the base model 206 horsepower engine and not with all-wheel drive.
Honda is the worst. They always do this with a good transmission. Hey, John, how many cylinders does your car have? Four? Oh, why? Well, because you wanted a stick and you can't get it with a six-cylinder.
I probably wouldn't have gotten the V6, though.
Don't ruin my moment. You're ruining my rant,
also,
John.
Also, I'm very curious. Can you explain to me, John, it says the industry's first 8-speed DCT with torque converter. What does that mean?
That can't be.
I don't know what that means.
How can you have a DCT and a torque converter?
Maybe it's like a dual transmission thing? It's got like an automatic transmission in front of it. It has, I don't understand. I don't understand at all. Here's the one-line summary from a recent Car and Driver review of the last year's model, which I think was just a cosmetic refresh. Automotive wallpaper from the same company that sells the NSX supercar.
So wow. A glowing review, huh?
Yeah. I say, how can that same company that makes that make this thing? Automotive wallpaper is not what you want to hear.
So I also have an issue with the NSX while we're on this topic.
The new one or the old one?
The new one. I have seen somebody in my town, somebody occasionally parks one like in town. So I see it occasionally now. It just is incredibly forgettable looking. Like the old NSX is incredibly distinctive. And I saw one of those like the same day, which is kind of amusing. Like, 'cause I almost never see those. But like the old NSX, you know it from a mile away. Like, and it looks incredibly distinctive and it looks cool. Even still today, it still looks cool, which is pretty impressive for a car of that era. The new one just looks like random expensive car. Like it doesn't look that distinctive anymore. Like it doesn't look bad. And it looks like a sports car, but it just looks like every other sports car now. And I feel like that's kind of a shame from the same company that the old one was just so distinctive.
Yeah, it was compromised by the... I mean, it had a difficult life. If you look at the development history of this NSX, at various times, many different configurations were planned to be the new NSX. And so it didn't have a good development. And I think it shows in the finished product, which is not bad, but... It is a kind of a mishmash of various compromises. And going hybrid, trying to be a hybrid supercar along with the big boys, right? But having that be a controversial decision and the way they executed it, not, you know, like it's so much better when you have a clear vision from the beginning and you develop based on it rather than like changing your mind three times during the development and like scrapping one plan and going with another and then tweaking and modifying it. And the styling feel like it suffers from the same thing. It's like they had to put a skin over this car they'd made and... It just seems too high to me, and they tried to put family Honda resemblance in the front and rear treatments that don't quite work out. I haven't seen one in person, so I'll reserve judgment. Sometimes these cars look better in person, but every time I've seen one, you know, driving around on video reviews and stuff, looks all right, and it gets so-so reviews, but it you know, no one is wowed by it like they were by the old one, and the old one definitely... I mean, the complaint about the old one was that it looked like a Japanese Ferrari. That's kind of what they were going for. But, like, Japanese Ferrari is a good look. This just looks like, I don't know. It looks like a slightly modified Acura, not Acura, Audi R8.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
very similar to the R8. I mean, I feel like if you want to buy, like, a really cool sports car, I'd get the old one before I get the new one.
Yeah, they have some problems, too. And also, you see one of those in real life and you realize, wow, those tires are tiny. It looks like a little, like, looks like a skateboard. It's like 15-inch tires or something on it. It's just ridiculous.
Well, the car isn't very big on the old one, but it is. It's like 25 feet long, though. Like it's a very long car.
It's not. You're just fooled by the proportion of the tires. Like everything about it is small. Like the beautiful thing about the NSX is that they did have a clear vision, and I think it's a great vision that like it was a competitive advantage that they had over the things that they were sort of imitating, like Ferrari and everything. Like their inspiration for the overall shape of the car was the F-16 cockpit, where the cockpit is a bubble up above the level of all the rest of the stuff in the plane, so that when you're a pilot, you look around and you can see things on all sides of you. You're not like looking over the big lump. You know, it's not the cockpit is not sort of like the back of the spine of the plane goes along and then slopes downward, and that's the cockpit. And when you look backward, you would just see like nothing, like you're driving a panel truck or something. They said, no, the plane is going to be down here. And then the cockpit will be coming up off the top of it, so you have a panoramic view. And that's what they did with the car. The car is down there in the NSX, and the canopy, the sort of the roof line, that's where you are, and you can look around in all directions. So they had skinny pillars because of lax crash standards, right? And amazing visibility compared to any other mid-engine car like a Ferrari, where you have like a tiny slit out the back because the giant engine is back there, and sometimes they even put like slits in there like in the older 80s models and stuff to make it so you have terrible visibility, huge seat pillars, huge blind spots, and then they got to put these giant side mirrors so you can see anything and you feel kind of like you're trapped. More people should be copying that, because that, you know, if you can't actually make yourself look and perform like a Ferrari, one of the only advantages you have as a supercar, you know, an affordable supercar or a supercar wannabe, is you can be ergonomically better than the supercars. And that's what the NSX did. It looked cool, it looked interesting, and had amazing ergonomics, you know. And the new one, it's also mid-engine, and its ergonomics don't look that great. It looks like it has pretty darn big C-pillars, and the visibility out the back, while better than a Ferrari, is nowhere near what it was in the original NSX.
They can be had for as little as $40,000 for a 100,000 mile month. 100,000.
They're going up now since we had in our initial episode where we had to pick a car for 25K and I picked the NSX. Good luck finding a 25K NSX now that's in reasonable condition because they are creeping up.
Did we do that?
Yeah, remember you said if you have $25,000, what car should you get? And you two picked terrible cars, and I picked the NSX because I'm a genius.
Oh my god, what did we pick? I remember us picking.
You picked something terrible.
Bad cars.
I would like a Toyota Camry, like something terrible. I'm like, no, you get an Acura NSX.
I probably said like a used 3 Series or something.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember both of us picking truly terrible choices, and it took a little convincing for me to decide that. But yeah, I agree that it was not good.
You can get a DeLorean for about that much.
That's a crap.
Oh, that is a terrible, terrible choice.
I didn't say it was my choice. I'm just saying you can't get one.
A DeLorean is furniture. It's not a car. Or it's like a lawn ornament. It just looks good sitting there, but God, I would never want to drive one. Although they're making the new ones now that I would presume are a little bit better. You know, did you know about this? They're like,
have they actually made them yet, or are they just talking about it?
New DeLorean production update. Here we go. In December 2015, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm too lazy to read this, but apparently it's happening, I guess.
Is it the same? Are they just making like the same car again, just like with new parts?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like not any design updates or anything, like just making the same thing again.
Correct. I don't even think they're doing the like Singer treatment where Singer will take an old Porsche. It is Singer, right? That takes an old Porsche and like guts the interior. I shouldn't say the interior, but completely reworks the mechanicals such that they're like these ridiculous performance cars that are using, and I think this is what you're driving at, Marco, using, like 2017 era parts, but in a 1960s era Porsche. I don't think that's what DeLorean's doing. I think they're doing at most like a modest update or upgrade, but it's mostly the same stuff you saw in the early 80s.
So the problem with the DeLorean is that...
The problem?
Is it like we all have nostalgia about Back to the Future and how cool it was back then and how cool it looked back then. And it's such an incredibly rare car that like most of us have never actually even seen one in real life, let alone, have ever ridden in one or driven one or anything else. So if you tell someone like, oh, we're bringing back the DeLorean, like a lot of people who are roughly in our age group would be like, yeah, cool, that sounds awesome. But like, you've been able to buy a DeLorean for like the last 20 years for, a reasonable amount of money. Like, last time I looked, you could get one that was very lightly used and had a bunch of like new parts for like $25,000, like in like totally restored condition. Like that's really not that much money for like a crazy second fun car, So it's not like you haven't been able to get them all this time. You have. And still, practically nobody has actually sought one out and bought one. And because, like, it turns out, like, in person, they don't look that impressive. They look really 80s, like really extremely 80s. From the car nerd's perspective, like, it isn't a particularly fun or fast or compelling car to drive. If they're going to bring it back, in quotes, like in finger quotes, without really making any changes to it that would make it like a more interesting car to enthusiasts, who's gonna buy it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Back to the Future fans,
I guess so.
Yeah, but Back to the Future fans have been able to spend $25,000 to buy one for years.
The new ones will be more reliable, and you'll be able to get parts for them a little bit easier, and then hopefully drive a little bit better. And so then it's getting over that hump of I don't want an actual DeLorean because it's just, a terrible car and unreliable and difficult to repair. And these new ones presumably will improve in all those ways. So it finally gets you over the hump to have the silly nostalgic thing. I'm hoping. I mean, why are they doing new ones? They should just fill it with Honda, Toyota parts so it actually works and then keep the outside the same.